Good evening. We'll call this meeting of the Job Growth, Energy Affordability, Policy and Finance Committee to order. Today is Tuesday, April 7th. Representative Loon, we do not have a quorum yet, but at the appropriate time, we will move House File 328 for possible inclusion in a later bill. And so with that, also members of the committee, members of the audience, later on I'll be doing a walkthrough of the schedule for the week, but we'll wait until a member of my caucus is here to join me. So, Representative Loon, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I will briefly discuss what would be in House File 328 when you have it before you, and then allow my testifier who's here to give you all of the great details. House File 328 is what we're calling MINVEST, which if any of you are familiar with crowdfunding, it basically takes this concept where you can, through crowdfunding, which exists, and in fact, Minnesota is a state that's embraced it with great gusto. But normally you make a contribution through this online mechanism and maybe get a T-shirt or a commemorative CD or something. This would take the concept and expand it into an investment tool where small businesses could raise capital and where ordinary people could become investors in companies. They have to be Minnesota-based companies, and you have to be a resident of Minnesota to be able to do this. And all of this is sort of the outgrowth of actually federal legislation that passed in 2012. The Jobs Act at the federal level directed the Securities Exchange Commission to develop rules pursuant to allowing crowdfunding and for small businesses to use the internet to find potential investors. But the SEC has been working on rules for, I'll let Zach tell you the number of days, but many, it's been years now since then. And so what has happened is that states have taken up the cause and passed legislation themselves to allow this to be done on a state-by-state basis, which is the reason why you have to be a Minnesota-based company and a Minnesota resident to participate. Basically, it would allow businesses to advertise their offerings to Minnesota residents. This would be done through what's called a portal, which would be an online tool that would be registered with the Department of Commerce. It would allow individuals who are non-accredited investors to contribute or to make a contribution through MINVEST and receive an equity stake in that company. It does limit the amount of money that a company could raise through this. My bill limits it to $2 million or $5 million, depending on the type of offering and the level of scrutiny on that company. It also limits the amount of money that an investor could invest in a company of $10,000. The issuers, so the company doing the issuing, must provide detailed information on their and disclosure in their documents about the company and would meet statutory requirements doing so. All of the funds will be held in escrow in an FDIC-insured account until the company reaches the minimum funding target. And again, the portals will be subject to stringent record-keeping requirements and would be overseen by the Department of Commerce. So with that, I'll let Mr. Robbins tell you a little bit more about the program.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. Zach Robbins. I'm an attorney with Winthrop & Weinstein. Thank you for allowing me to testify today. I'll try to be brief. I think that Representative Loon did an excellent job of describing the bill. And just wanted to add that on a daily basis, I work with clients who try to launch companies, and the biggest challenge is accessing capital. And so what this system will allow for is the ability for anyone in this state to back essentially any company that wants to conduct an offering within this state. That's a very powerful tool for those that haven't typically had access to capital. Over the past 12 months, we've worked very hard in trying to put together a coalition of supporters. So I just wanted to briefly name some of the groups that have backed us and supported us so far. Everyone from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce to the Black Chamber of Commerce to Life Science Alley, MHTA, Mojo, TAI, ACG, Small Business, Minnesota Social Enterprise Alliance, Twin Cities, Metro IBA, St. Paul Area Chamber of Commerce, and so on. We have a very broad group backing us, and we We've spent quite a bit of time over the past 2 months in sitting down with the Department of Commerce and making sure that they're comfortable with the bill, and we're happy to say that both sides are on the same page now, and things have progressed very well. So I'm happy to answer any questions today. Thank you once again for the opportunity.
Thank you. Representative Loon, do you have any other invited testifiers?
I do not, Mr. Chair.
This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Come on down, sir. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Yeah, hi, my name is Rick Heller. I unofficially represent the Twice Exceptional and Quick Disabled, speaking on House File 328. On your bill summary, under the overview, talks about MN Best website portal. And then under Section 1 on the same page, under Subdivision 1, definition. My question is, I don't know if the chair would let anyone, the yield from Commerce. I believe I heard Commerce is the one that's going to be taking care of the accessibility with this website.
Well, Mr. Hellier, testifiers do not ask other testifiers to yield. You can certainly ask a question, and if someone voluntarily comes forward, they may do that, but you cannot do that. But please continue.
It's been effective before, and obviously it's up to the chair's discretion. Thank you. So the question is, will this porthole be accessible to content accessibility law, since it seems to be a third-party vendor involved in it, 16E.03?
And I think what we'll do is, Mr. Fortner, if you could write down Mr. Hellier's question, or Mr. Hellier, if you want to write down the question and supply.
Actually, as I speak, it's a transcript if you like it. However, they heard it, and there's many scribes here. My writing ability is not the best.
Well, Mr. Fortner,
however,
you can
review oral is better, and I appreciate you allowing the appropriate accommodations for this hearing.
Sure. What we'll do is, so Mr. Fortner, if you got the question, you can speak with Mr. Hellier offline, or you can go back and listen to the committee tape and forward that question to department staff, to the Department of Commerce. Did you have a follow-up question, Mr. Hellier?
Of course. Basically, it has to do with federal law. Federal laws, agencies such as Commerce are required to follow 508 of the 1973 Rehabilitation Act. Minnesota has moved the bar up not only to include 508, but also to include 2.0 web content accessibility guidelines. So again, for those who want to start a new business, as an opportunity for the pre-readers and non-readers, not just the blind and visually impaired, they all need an opportunity to have appropriate access, and that's why I'm speaking today. And thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you very much. This is a public hearing. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion and move to member questions and comments. Before we do that, though, we do have a quorum, so we'll call the meeting to order. Representative Loon and Representative Simonson moves approval of the minutes dated March 25th. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails, and the minutes are adopted. Now, Representative Loon, the chair will move that House File 328 be considered for possible inclusion in a later bill, and we are on to member questions or comments. Questions or comments from members? Pretty concise. Representative Loon, any closing comments?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. We've been through several committees with this. I want to thank Mr. Robbins and his associate, Mr. Phil Kraut, for all of their hard work on this. I think this is really shaped up into be something that's going to be a great tool for raising capital for small businesses and also for individuals in Minnesota that want to support a local small business and growing business that they'd like to be investors in. So I thank the committee for their consideration.
Thank you, Representative Loon. With that, the chair renews his motion to have House File 328 laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Loon, and to our testifiers.
Thank you.
And members, you'll notice the fiscal note on that bill was passed around, so you know you have that in your packets on that. Representative Sanders. And again, members, tonight, it's the chair's intent that the final motion on each bill will be to lay over for possible inclusion. I know people have other committees meeting or other activities, so That's the chair's intent, but on that. So, Representative Sanders, do you have someone to move your bill?
I heard Representative Fabian was excited.
Representative Fabian moves House File 776 for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative Sanders, there's an A-10 amendment. Is that yours?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that is.
All right. Representative Fabian, on behalf of the author, moves the A-10 amendment to put the bill in the form that the author would like. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. Representative, do you have any other amendments, Representative Sanders?
No, Mr. Chair, not that okay. I'm aware of.
I don't see any either. I just wanted to make sure. So, Representative Sanders, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this bill, House File 776, we believe is an important bill. Deals with VoIP or Voice over Internet Protocol. We've had so much growth and advancement in technology over the last few years. We want to make sure that Minnesota, in particular, is a state and a place where this growth and these solutions continue to grow and expand. At the rate that the market is ready for them. And we've been working a lot with a lot of outside groups, including this A-10 amendment that was just adopted, is language that we've agreed to with from the Department of Public Safety with all the TAP-TAM 911 language. So we should all be good and on the same page in that direction. This bill has been thoroughly vetted in Commerce Committee. I think we had two hearings on it in that committee. Being here mostly because of the fiscal note, which this committee certainly can deal with and take up. We think the fiscal note's a little heavy, and just that it basically takes the assumption that everybody's going to move from landlines directly onto VoIP technology, which don't think that that's happening. Nor will it happen. So aside from that, Mr. Chair, we would ask for member support and ask to be included in the omnibus bill.
Representative Sanders, before we move on to your invited testifiers and public comment, I do think it's important to note that we have a preliminary fiscal note on this bill. So it's still under construction, and I'm wondering if Ms. Hendricks could briefly cover that and give us an estimate of when we believe the final fiscal note will be available for the committee to review. And what her favorite animal is as well.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll pass on that final question and think about that. But on the fiscal note, we have a preliminary fiscal note with both Commerce and PUC reporting the fiscal impact of this bill for these two agencies. I think we're expecting the sign-off to be hopefully within the next day or two, but that might depend on the amendment that was adopted just now. But for the Commerce Department and PUC, both estimate a reduction in assessment due to this bill, due to the exclusion of the voice over internet provider services. And so the cost to the general fund as these assessments come into the general fund as non-dedicated revenue for Commerce Department is $376,000 for fiscal year 16, $353,000 for fiscal year 17, and those are ongoing costs. For the PUC, it would be $375,000 in fiscal year 16 and $351,000 in fiscal year 2017, and also ongoing reductions in assessment and thus reductions into the general fund. So for a total for the biennium, a reduction in assessment of $1.455 million for the 16-17 biennium.
And again, Ms. Hendricks, what we'll do is when that preliminary fiscal note becomes final, we'll make sure we share it with members of the committee using our planning documents. Representative Sanders, do you have any invited testifiers?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, Mr. Mendoza here.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Tony Mendoza. I'm counsel to the Minnesota Cable Communications Association. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm happy to be here today to address Cable Association's support for House File 776. This month, Minnesota will be celebrating the 100-year anniversary of Chapter 237, which is the chapter of Minnesota statutes that established regulation of telephone services in Minnesota. Many of these laws date back to an era when there was one provider of telephone service and no federal telecommunications regulatory scheme. It'd be an understatement to say that today the telecommunications industry is vastly different, perhaps unrecognizable for someone that was alive in 1915. Today there are myriad ways of communicating with one another: voice calls, texting, email, video conferencing, and social media. And the market for all of these services is extremely competitive. Historically, telephone calls were made using circuit switch technology. When you picked up the phone and dialed, you had a dedicated circuit for your call. Internet technology has fundamentally changed the way we make phone calls and the competitive landscape for voice communication services. Many companies now provide phone services using the same technology that providers of email, texting, and other web applications use. Instead of tying up a circuit for a phone call, voice signals are packetized into data, transported via broadband, and miraculously reassembled at the other end to allow your call to get to the person you dialed in real time. This technology has come to be known as Voice over Internet Protocol technology, or for short, VoIP, and it runs, like other applications, over broadband networks. At the federal level, a critical and prescient distinction was made in the 1960s in a series of regulatory decisions called the computer inquiries. To spare you a lot of geek law mumbo-jumbo, the essence of those decisions boils down to this: the act of transporting information and the act of processing information are two different things. The distinction in the computer inquiries has evolved into two definitions under federal law: telecommunication services, or transport, and information services, or processing. You may have heard something lately about a decision that the FCC just released, the Open Internet or Net Neutrality Order. In that order, the FCC categorized broadband, not VoIP, as the act of transporting information. Services falling into this transport category, like broadband, are subject to greater federal regulatory oversight now under the Net Neutrality Order. Services that fall into the other category, data processing, email, texting, and web surfing, are unregulated services. Today we refer to them as apps or applications. The FCC and federal courts have preempted states from applying common carrier-style transport regulations to VoIP services. There is no more justification for applying burdensome centuries-old telephone regulations to VoIP than there is for applying those laws and regulations to email, texting, data processing, or social media. You've heard opponents, and you may hear your opponents, talk about the hundreds of thousands of phone customers that could be affected by this bill, with the implication that that impact will be negative. But consider, according to the FCC, at the end of 2013, there were more than 852,000 VoIP subscriber lines in Minnesota receiving service from 116 VoIP providers. 465,000 of these lines were residential lines, 387,000 were business. And these numbers have likely increased since then. In that context, the number of complaints to Minnesota regulatory agencies about VoIP service is de minimis, especially compared to the hundreds of millions of calls those customers placed in 2014. The actual number of complaints has not been documented either by the Department of Commerce or the OAG. In all of 2014, the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission, in a document filed by the Department of Commerce, documented only 22 consumer complaints about the two largest VoIP providers in Minnesota. And many, if not all, of these complaints may have had nothing to do with VoIP services. House File 776 does not eliminate carrier of last resort obligations that apply to traditional landline services. 29 states have adopted VoIP deregulation, and no one in those states is losing access to phone service. And a report by the National Regulatory Research Institute also concluded that after these states have passed retail VoIP deregulation and other telecommunications retail deregulation efforts, prices have not generally increased, and again, carrier of last resort obligations have not been removed. Industry stakeholders have worked out acceptable language, as you've seen in the A10 amendment, related to compliance with state 911 laws by VoIP providers. The law today could not be more clear that VoIP providers must comply with 911 requirements at the state and federal level. The FCC required VoIP providers to comply with 911 laws and regulations back in 2005. Congress also required VoIP providers to comply with 911 laws and rules and state-specific 911 regulations. And the telecommunications industry has worked with Minnesota 911 agencies to update the state's 911 laws. Any claim that House File 776 weakens the 911 program is simply wrong. But in the abundance of caution, we have clarified that 911 regulations in the A10 amendment clearly apply to VoIP providers. With respect to TAP 911, the Telephone Assistance Plan, the Telecommunications Access Minnesota plan, program, House File 776 will strengthen these programs by ensuring that more VoIP providers pay into these funds. And that's something I'm not sure that it's clear that the fiscal note addresses, that more providers may be paying into both into the 911 TAP and TAM fund, because it clarifies that all VoIP providers must comply with those statutes and pay into those funds. Also, MCCA has worked with proponents and authors of the bill to strengthen provisions protecting the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission's authority over wholesale services and interconnection. If players aren't playing nice with one another behind the scenes, we need to have a forum that we can go to, and that is the Public Utilities Commission. And this bill protects the Commission's authority over interconnection disputes and wholesale services. The Cable Association represents some of the largest competitive wireline providers in the state. We all need the ability to interconnect with one another, and the amendment and the bill actually contains language that ensures we can do so. The Federal Telecommunications Act of 1996 says it is the policy of the United States to preserve the vibrant and competitive free market that presently exists for the Internet and other interactive computer services, unfettered by federal or state regulation. And the FCC has said this about VoIP regulation: we cannot permit more than 50 different jurisdictions to impose traditional common carrier regulations, such as Minnesota's. And this is in a case involving Vonage Holdings, which was an early VoIP provider, and still meet our responsibility to realize Congress's objective. The FCC has stated its desire for a national uniform policy. House File 776 aligns Minnesota with that national uniform policy. The Cable Association strongly supports House File 776. It ensures that investment and development in technologies like VoIP and other IP-enabled services will not be restrained by century-old legacy common carrier regulations, and aligns Minnesota with the FCC's goal to have a nationwide uniform policy with respect to VoIP, while at the same time protecting important state interests such as high-quality 911, TAP, TAM, and the seamless interconnection of telecommunications networks. Thank you. That concludes my testimony, and I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you. Representative Sanders, do you have any other invited testifiers?
No, Mr. Chair. This will do it.
Okay. We're going to do a switch of the chair here before we... we're going to go through public testimony first, and then Representative Johnson, you'll be the first one up, okay?
It's a public meeting. Would anybody in the audience like to testify for or against the bill? Please step forward.
Thank you, Chair.
Could you please state your name for the record?
My name is Rick Heller, and I officially represent the Twice Exceptional and Print Disabled speaking on House File 776. As I've mentioned before, I think it's relevant that my conversations do not go to internal documents. They need to become public documents. This is a public affair. I'd like to speak on this bill, frankly, again, 776, which prohibits state regulations. I hope it doesn't restrict content accessibility law. I currently know that the FCC has made statements that cable is exempt from closed captioning. What does that say for the blind and visually impaired? We need to figure out fiscal notes when we start doing any kind of exemptions regarding responsibility and accountability. I ask that you at least do an advisory and perhaps bring it up in conference, because again, if this is uniform, I just don't know if it's uniform with Minnesota statute, especially, you know, when it comes to web accessibility 2.0, which is higher than 508 on the federal level. Again, Minnesota has adopted 508 and 2.0 web content accessibility guidelines. I think it's relevant to the if the last party that was up here, it seems very knowledgeable about the information. And regarding the TAM fund, I believe the TAM fund goes to Minute, also known accessibility officer Jay Wyant, also known Office Enterprise Technology prior. I was wondering if the individual that was testifying last would be able to at least explain to this committee and the public at large if this is relevant to this bill.
Thank you.
And since that individual doesn't step forward, I'll accept that it's relevant and it's factual, and we don't speak up, we don't ante up when things are factual. So, again, if that individual doesn't come forward, that just tells us again that we're not going to start the discussion and bring that into this mix. I think it's important that that individual had an opportunity to speak, and since they chose to waive it, then perhaps this is relevant to have a discussion in the future. Thank you for this opportunity to speak.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Sanders, any response? No, thank you. Please state your name.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Peter Brickwoody, Director of Government Affairs for the Commerce Department. I'll be brief. The Commerce Department does have some significant concerns with House File 776, and we've discussed them at length in the Commerce Committee, so I won't address them in full. To summarize, the major concerns are that the definition of IP is so broad under the bill that it's likely that virtually every telephone company in the state could claim that the services fit. And we are concerned significantly so about the changes and eliminations of potential consumer protections. But Mr. Chairman, as I said, as Representative Sanders indicated earlier, this bill has received a couple of hearings in the Commerce Committee, so I'll leave it at that. I will note, just because there was some discussion earlier about the fiscal note, the Commerce Department section of the fiscal note is final, so I can't speak for the other agencies, but that portion of the note, at least, is final, and happy to answer questions from members if they would like.
Any member questions? Thank you. Any other testifiers? Welcome. Please state your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is James Canaday. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Attorney General's Office. I'm an Assistant Attorney General in the office and the manager of the Residential Utilities and Antitrust Division. The Attorney General's Office is opposed to this bill. As was stated by the testifier from the Department of Commerce, it has been addressed in another committee multiple times, so I'll give you the short version of the testimony this evening. The Attorney General's Office is opposed to this bill because it could potentially affect consumer protections in a way that we're very concerned about. The state does currently have some regulation over VoIP services, and this bill would end that and change that. And the Public Utilities Commission has found as recently as in November of 2014 that the FCC has not preempted all state regulation of VoIP services. So this bill would be a fundamental shift in the way that VoIP services are regulated in the state. We would ask that the bill not pass. We think that the committee and the legislature should keep options open in the future for this emerging area of technology. As has been mentioned by the proponent of the bill, a number of the services that people receive and think of as plain telephone service are actually moving to VoIP technologies. What's important from the consumer point of view is that when you pick up the phone, you have a dial tone. You're able to call, you're able to reach 911 or family and friends, and not necessarily the technology behind the phone call. So as those technologies transition to these VoIP services, it's not going to necessarily be obvious to consumers that the telephone service provided with the new technology is regulated in a different way. With that, we ask that the committee not support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further any questions of the committee? Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you be a little more clear on what consumer protections you're referring to that may be lost by this? I don't serve on the Commerce Committee, so I didn't get to hear any of those discussions.
Mr. Kennedy.
Yeah. Currently, VoIP services that are fixed in nature, so that is services provided by cable operators, for example, like Comcast or Charter, that provide service are regulated through the PUC, and those have not been preempted. So they're subject to the same regulation that telephone service provided by CenturyLink are subject to. This bill would preempt any type of regulation of VoIP services just by nature of the technology that's used to provide them. So there's a whole host of consumer protections, and fundamentally it would just be the fact that the PUC would no longer have any oversight over these matters. So if it was quality of service, pricing, anything imaginable, frankly, this would take away regulation by the Public Utilities Commission. There is a current docket at the Public Utilities Commission where Charter Communications, it's been alleged, has moved customers from plain telephone service to VoIP service, and the Department of Commerce has actually filed a lengthy complaint alleging, I believe, 10 different types of consumer protections that customers have lost because they are no longer, because they've been moved to VoIP services. And for the record, I can give you the docket number of that proceeding, because I think it directly gets to what we're talking about here tonight. And I would note that Mr. Mendoza, who testified in support of the bill, I believe represents Charter, the company that's been alleged of wrongdoing in that case. The docket number of the PUC is 14-383.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Clark.
Thank you. You know, I doubt that I'll get to go look up a docket number. Could you just tell us, you said there are 10 different consumer protections that could be lost. Can you just give us some examples? I noticed you mentioned pricing, quality of service, but I really, 10 is a pretty significant number. I'm curious to know a little bit more about that, if you can help me. Thank you.
I was trying to give you the short version still, and I appreciate the fact that you're asking for more detailed information. Let me read the headings of the different categories that the Department of Commerce has alleged as violations in that case. And if anybody would like more information, I'd be happy to follow up by providing copies of these documents. The first are the slamming and loading laws in Minnesota that are currently consumer protections. By way of example there, what slamming refers to is the unauthorized switch of a telephone provider without the consumer's consent. And that is certainly that we have something with issues and that we see in my division at the Attorney General's office. The second violation alleged is the certification requirements that are required under Minnesota Statute Section 237.16 that requires telephone companies to obtain a certificate of authority for operation in the state. The third violation is acquisition of property, assets, and obligations of another company without the permission of the Public Utilities Commission. The fourth violation alleged are the basic service requirements, which are in the Minnesota rules at 7812.0600. Those rules, among other things, prohibit providers from withdrawing from service territories without permission. So, for example, that's an important way that the Public Utilities Commission ensures that there are service providers available to everyone. The next two violations involve the TAM and TAP programs in the state of Minnesota, which provide subsidization of equipment and on bill credits for low-income and communication-impaired Minnesotans. The next violation is one of unfair competition, which is specific to the facts in that case. The next set of violations is, I'm trying to summarize here, forgive me. Allegations of violation of an earlier commission order related to Charter's promises made at the Public Utility Commission in an earlier order. And also it looks like the last violation is failure to file annual reports and regulatory assessments by Charter. Overall, what this case gets at is the fact that when Charter, which had previously operated in the state as a CLEC and subject to the communications laws that we're familiar with for telephone companies in the state, switched to VoIP technology, they claimed that they were no longer subject to the laws and rules and regulations that fall into those categories that I just went through. And what that means at the end of the day is they're claiming that the Public Utilities Commission does not have any authority over them to compel compliance with these requirements or to protect consumers in a variety of ways that can come up. And we think that what this legislation would do would not only tell Charter that it's okay to do that, it's going to encourage and incentivize that from every telephone company in the state. It tells them that if they switch the technology that's behind their switches and their lines to VoIP technology, they're no longer subject to the regulations and the protections that they're currently subject to.
Representative Sanders, would you like to respond to any of the information that we've been given?
Yes, Mr. Chair. If I could have Mr. Mendoza come back up to the table.
Mr. Mendoza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tony Mendoza on behalf of the Minnesota Cable Communications Association. Again, I would like to respond to Mr. Kennedy's comments about PUC action. First of all, you need to know that the primary question in that docket is whether the commission does have jurisdiction over VoIP providers. That is not a settled question in Minnesota. We believe the FCC has preempted all state regulation over VoIP providers. The department has taken a different position. And so all of the so-called violations that Mr. Kennedy just listed for you are all premised on this idea that the state does have jurisdiction. But I will note all of the violations that are alleged are based on not a single customer complaint. There is no allegation that a customer complained about anything that Charter Communications did in transferring its customers from a regulated entity to an unregulated entity when it made the transition to VoIP services. The other important thing to know is that most of, or I would say a good portion of the industry in terms of VoIP providers are already deregulated by the FCC, and the FCC has clearly preempted state regulatory authority over nomadic VoIP providers, which are fierce competitors to fixed wireline based VoIP providers like the cable companies and many others. So this issue is, and this is the reason that other states have taken this issue on. 29 other states have made it clear that you know, we're going to follow the FCC's lead on deregulating and preempting state regulation over VoIP services. Oh, one thing about the slamming issue is an interesting one because it's physically impossible for a cable customer to be slammed. In the old days, slamming was a situation where JD operators, long-distance companies mostly, could call a customer and talk them into switching their long-distance company truly without their authorization or without following adequate procedures that have been put in place to address that problem. But for cable providers that are offering VoIP services, it actually requires a truck roll to go out to the consumer's house and physically disconnect and change out software at that customer's home that drive that provide the VoIP service. So it's not possible for technically possible for a customer of a VoIP provider, a fixed VoIP provider, to be slammed.
And also, Mr. Chair, I'll just say quickly too. I mean, Mr. Kennedy mentioned the TAM-TAP stuff in that in the current docket, but this bill is specifically in the A-10. Addresses all the concerns with public safety and 911, so we believe that those issues in this bill are fixed and do provide excellent consumer protections, at least when it comes to 911. And again, very, very similar language all across this country. 31 states have enacted very similar language. Over half of those states have been with Democratic governors, so very bipartisan in nature. Many states receiving, you know, North Dakota, I think, just 2 weeks ago, unanimous. West Virginia just over, I think, was just signed into law yesterday. So, you know, the concern is if we don't move in this direction as well, Minnesota will be an outlier instead of being a place where this technology can flourish.
Okay. Representative Johnson, then we'll have Representative Hartman, Mensa, and Fabian. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Mendoza, can you show me in the bill where TAP would be supported by revenues? I wasn't clear on that point. It sounded like you said that was the case. But would the telephone assistance program, is that clearly in here that it would be funded? If it is, I missed it. Maybe you could point that out to me.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Mendoza.
Representative Johnson, I believe it's section 237.52, which addresses the TAP program, and that would be on page 2, line 7, where it says, to the extent permitted by federal law, VoIP service is subject to the requirements of sections 237.49, which is the combined access surcharge, that's TAP, TAM, and 911, 237.52, which I believe is the TAP statute, and 403.11, which I believe is the 911 statute.
Representative Johnson.
Oh, very good. I wasn't clear on that, so I'll check now. I appreciate that. Just briefly, I guess I'll make some comments, because it is a very complicated and hard to understand issue sometimes. But since all phone traffic is IP, has an IP component anyway, because of its efficiency, as you noted, essentially all telephone service would be deregulated. And to me, that's the big deal. Everything, all the telephone service would be deregulated. And so it's a pretty radical bill in that regard. Now, the FCC hasn't decided, as you said, whether VoIP is a federal or state jurisdiction matter. I think that is correct. So I'm not sure why Minnesota would want to take away oversight of VoIP right now before the FCC is clear on that point, since that still is muddied. And since the FCC recently classified broadband internet as a telecommunication service, subject to utility-style regulatory authority, it does not seem the timing to move forward on this bill is a good idea. And as somebody noted, probably the guy from the AG, that there's a docket before the Minnesota PUC on Charter, and they're trying to figure out whether VoIP is an information or telecommunication service, and that hearing is coming up in May 6th through 8th, I believe. So that's another reason, I think, to hold off on moving forward on this kind of legislation. But the big issue for me, members, is the public oversight. And I really do think we need that to ensure that universal, affordable, quality telephone service, irrespective of the technology, whether it's IP or some future technology. These are some of the issues that would no longer be insured to be regulated. Those include rural call completion, obligations to serve in high cost areas, that's carry of last resort issues, notification of rate increases, oversight of rates and service quality, affordability of standalone basic service, transparency or truth in billing. These are some huge issues I think make sense for public oversight to occur and is involves good public policy. What this bill does is no longer make that in effect. So to that extent, I think it's not a bill that Minnesota needs now. It's not a bill that Minnesota consumers need now. So that's kind of my take on it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Is there anybody else from the public that wants to testify either for or against at this point? If not, Representative Mensa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. During the previous testimony, Mr. Mendoza did. I got my questions answered. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. I failed to close the public testimony, so at this point we will go to other committee member questions and start with Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could ask Mr. Kennedy to come back down again, please. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kennedy, a question just real quickly. You were going through your list of concerns, and you were talking about the you started out talking about alleged violations, and as you got through your list, I counted at least the last four, you did not refer to them as alleged violations. Was that a mistake on your part, or are they violations?
Mr. Kennedy.
Mr. Chair, we'll call that a mistake on my part.
Thank you.
These are the alleged violations in the PUC docket I referred to.
Any other member questions? Seeing none. Final comments, Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, this is it's a very complex issue, as Representative Johnson mentioned. But I think it's important that we do add some clarity right now in Minnesota as to what Minnesota's stance is going to be on emerging technologies and emerging solutions as we move forward. Every legislator has a VoIP phone. Our phone systems here are VoIP. This allows tremendous access, allows tremendous opportunity for technology and for all those folks, whether it be rural Minnesota or here in the metro. 31 states, again, have enacted almost identical language, very similar language all across this country. So it's time that we add some certainty and clarity here in Minnesota and ask for member support, and would appreciate being included in the omnibus.
Thank you. With that, the bill is laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Committee, for your time.
We'll now move on to House File 579, Representative Franson.
They have a two-port vehicle.
Representative Fabian, would you like to move the bill?
I sure will, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
House File 579.
Representative Fabian moves 579 for possible inclusion. Representative Franzen.
Thank you, members. House File 579 is a funding request for the Greater Minnesota Business Development Public Infrastructure Grant Program, or simply put, the BDPI program. BDPI was first funded in 2003 and has a proven track record of job creation and tax-based development. 166 Greater Minnesota cities have been awarded BDPI grants, which have created over 1,600 new jobs and retained over 6,000 additional jobs. Too often, the debate at the legislature has focused on the total funding for the program. It is important to think not just about the overall funding, but to keep in mind that the average grant under the program is $279,000. Only three grants in the entire history of BDPI have been for more than $500,000. While the grants may seem modest compared to other programs funded by the state, to the communities that receive a BDPI grant, it is often a really big deal and has allowed projects to become a reality that otherwise would not have been. There are a few changes in the program found in this bill. Number one, the maximum grant per community would increase from $1 million to $2 million. Number two, awards would be made for 50% of the total project cost and not up to 50%. Over the years, the percentage of state funding has been dropping as DEED has had to manage stagnant funding. You may be asking why the BDPI program is open only to Greater Minnesota cities. Often, similar projects in the metro area of such significance in size that they get a standalone appropriation, which is not a bad thing. However, the BDPI program was designed to allow smaller communities the same opportunity to create jobs and economic activity. Thank you for your time and consideration, and I do believe that there is an amendment.
Yes, Representative Franson, there is an amendment.
Mr. Chair, I'll move it.
Thank you. Amendment is moved. It's Metza moves the what we will call the A1. That isn't labeled the A1, but consider it to be that. Any discussion on the amendment? Input on the amendment? Representative?
Mr. Chair, I see that Representative Metza has authored the amendment. Moved the amendment. I'm just wondering who authored the amendment.
Representative Franzen, do you have a comment on the amendment?
I believe that Mr. Seifert.
Please identify yourself.
Mr. Chair, Marty Seifert with the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. Representative Mahoney, after discussions in Representative Gunther's committee, we were asked to consult with the deed department on some concerns they may have had with the bill, and so this was basically a reconciliation of issues they may have had with it, so we decided to remove those sections. So it puts it in the proper form for everyone to agree on.
Representative Mahoney.
So, Mr. Chair, this is essentially an office amendment?
Yes.
That is correct.
Thank you.
Any further discussion on the amendment? If not, all in favor? Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. The bill is in the shape that you wanted it, as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have some testifiers here that will speak more to the bill at hand.
Seifert.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for having us. Marty Seifert with the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. We represent over 85 communities in rural Minnesota. We want to thank Representative Franson for offering this bill. This is one of the top job-creating initiatives, we believe, in rural Minnesota that helps meet the but-for test on retaining or creating jobs in our communities. Many of you received, I hope everyone received one of these handouts. It gives you just a quick snapshot of the jobs created and retained that have been tracked from the deed department. The 2014 appropriations that were done last year are so far listed in here, although the city of Willmar just received a grant, I think Representative Baker, it was probably like a week ago, something like that. So they're not on the map. There's a couple that didn't make it. And then throughout the history of the program, for those of you who have been on the committee a long time, and I know Representative Clark and Representative Gunther have been on this committee a long time, and this program was started under the Ventura administration, was first funded under the Pawlenty administration. So there's a history of all the different grants that were given in this chart. And then on the back page, the total appropriations for the different bienniums are listed from 2003 through 2014. It's had strong bipartisan support in both bodies of the legislature. We believe it is a tool in the toolbox in rural Minnesota, particularly for border communities and those that need to have some modest infrastructure improvements in order to either expand an existing business or to bring in a business that may not be in Minnesota already. It could be hooking up or extending a sewer pipe, a water line, a small bridge or road, expansion of an industrial park or curb and gutter. Just to put a project together, we believe that it's a very strong program, and we believe that it's worthy of support in this legislative session. And that's all I have for you.
Any additional testifiers?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dan Dorman, the Executive Director of the Greater Minnesota Partnership. Partnership is strongly supportive of this bill. We have seen the results, the jobs created, the economic activity created, and we're stand for any questions and appreciate your support.
Representative Branson, any other testifiers?
No, Mr. Chair.
Question. Representative Wiggenius.
Thank you. I hear the need for the program, and then look at the change on line 1.9 where you don't say up to 50%, but you say 50%. How many fewer projects will get done if you have 50% rather than up to 50%?
Mr. Dorman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wiggenius, it would really depend on the applications that come from city, so it'd be hard to determine that, but if you see what the average grants are. The concern has been that as the funding has remained somewhat stagnant relative to other programs, think about most of this is a cash request, but most of the funding has come in terms of bonding. And if you're a standalone line in the bonding bill, often you do get the full 50%. But in order to stretch the dollars, if you will, what DEED has been doing is, as a percentage of the total project, been shrinking this down so that the, I just did an email blast to several cities a few weeks ago just to say, hey, of the last programs, what has the percentage been? And it's been gradually shrinking. A lot of them are now under 25%. So you know, the choice is if we can't get additional dollars into the program, they just keep shrinking it, it's going to become less and less of an effective tool. The direct answer to the question would depend on the nature of the projects that come forward in the cities that apply. But if no additional funding is put in the program, it would be clearly fewer. You know, if you do more, you know, fewer at 50% or more at 25%, I mean, that's true in many programs in state funding, however, as well.
Representative Woodgenius.
I mean, when I hear the breadth of the need to say it has to be 50% is an automatic saying we're going to fund fewer unless you were to substantially increase the money. Maybe it would be wiser to put a floor rather than, a different kind of floor between something and something. It doesn't seem intuitive the way it is here.
Mr. Dorman?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gaines, I think that the same thing could be true of many things that the state chooses to fund and don't fund, assuming that either this year or next year there's a bonding bill, you're going to see a whole lot of projects that you could say, well, let's not fund 50%, let's fund only 25% of them, we'll do more projects. I think that that's the same thing throughout. But I think we're starting to lose quality of projects. I think that's another factor that comes in there. And so we would be open, I think the author would, I think both organizations, other organizations would be open to other language that would get us to the same place, but so far none has came out. We sat down and had the discussion with Deed, and I don't think they really had a better solution either. They may not like it. I think they'd like to spread the money around. I understand that, but that's certainly not what's happening in other programs.
Thank you. It is a public meeting. Is there anybody from the audience that would like to testify either for or against? Seeing none, we'll move to committee questions and start with Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. can you say a little bit more about why you deleted Section 3, Representative Francis?
Yes, Representative Clark. Deed wasn't too keen on those provisions. So instead of bringing forward a bill and having angst with Deed, we just thought we'd take care of the problem and withdraw those items from the bill.
Mr. Chairman, maybe we could hear from Deed. Just Seifert pointed out, I have been on this committee, and those issues are dealing with being a benefit to the community being required by this kind of funding, which I have supported this kind of funding in the past, but taking out the fact that there's going to be a public benefit, that there's local match required, that there's not relocating a substantially same operation from another place. I mean, these are kind of some of the things that were put in to protect Main Street, for example, in some of the small cities. You know, I guess I'm just really trying to figure out why Deed or anybody agree with all of those, and maybe you're agreeing with certain parts and not others, so maybe you could give us some clarity on that.
Somebody from Deed, please identify yourself.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kim Babine. I am the Director of Government Affairs at Deed, and Representative Clark, what you are referring to is precisely why Deed had the problem with the change. So if you look on of the bill, page 2, line 16, it strikes will and replaces it with is likely to. So we wanted the stronger language to remain in statute to say that it is a requirement that the project result in substantial public-private capital investment.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Clark.
So I understand that you want to keep the strength of displacing also, for example, businesses on Main Street so that there can be another business maybe out in the outskirts to be. And so I understand, I think now, Representative Franson, that you're maintaining the parts of the legislation that Deed wants, not eliminating, not changing them. Okay. It's like a double negative. I finally got it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You could fool me. Representative Gunter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To either any testifiers, why are we asking for cash, especially with the short little targets we have, and not bonding like we usually get? You do understand what I'm saying, right? Very well.
Mr. Dorman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gunther, there is a companion bill that requests bonding appropriations as well. Last year, the fund was received funding both in cash and in bond appropriations. We're happy to have dollars that come from any source. The cash would allow DEED some flexibility, and there is language in here to give them more flexibility than they have. There would be an example that I can quickly think of where cash might be a handy thing for them would be a I know of one project where there is a storm detention pond being built. It would have been probably a little less costly to build it on private land, but using the existing program, you could not use that. So it doesn't require DEED to do anything different. It just gives them more flexibility if they believe they need it. So it's not a requirement that they do different things with the money, but it would give them flexibility to spend cash appropriations differently than bond funds.
Representative Gunther?
Another question I have is, why are we expanding it to $2 million? Do we want to get rid of this money faster, or is there specific projects you have in mind, or is there something that, are we out of money in this program right now? Stuff like that. I don't know. Why are we doing this?
Mr. Dorman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gunther, great question. If you look at other projects, for example, in the governor's bonding recommendations that came out today, he recommended funding of $2 million for the innovative BDPI program. I looked at some of the funding that had been done in there. Many of those projects were over $1 million. So I think there are projects that will come forward and have come forward that have been short-funded because of the cap in the program. The statutory cap is $1 million per community, but internally, at least the conversations I've had with DEED, they actually have an informal cap of $500,000, again, in an attempt to try to spread the money around. But I do think we're losing quality of projects when we do that, and it does seem rather odd that for a Greater Minnesota project, we're held to a different standard than other statewide projects.
One more question.
One more question.
Representative Gunther.
If we have a project in Greater Minnesota that's going to require more than $1 million, could we not author a bill to ask for more money than that?
Ms. Dorman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gunther, of course, absolutely. Same is true of the brownfield cleanup, the innovative BDPI, and several other programs. You know, the same could be true of all those other programs, and maybe that's a question for another day, that perhaps all those funds should have similar language to them. I don't think we would object to that.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually what Mr. Dorman neglected to say was that you had the opportunity to go to the MIF funds or the job creation funds and combine them with the BDPI. That's where you could have got the other money. But I have a couple of questions here. Representative Franzen, earlier you said that this money was going to Greater Minnesota because the metro area had its own pot of money to do this in. Could you tell me where that pot of money is? Because I don't know where it is.
Representative Franzen.
Just not its own pot of money, just a similar program. For example, the Phelan project that was put together in the 90s, and I believe Dan Dorman can speak to that project as well.
I'd love Representative to hear what Mahoney. The Phelan project was.
Mr. Chair Dorman. And Representative Mahoney, I'll have to dig back because I'm working a little bit from memory, but you may know the projects as well, because I think they were good projects. I think several of them I voted for, but there were individual line items and several bonding bills for the Phelan corridor, which has resulted in significant job growth. I don't think they're bad projects at all, Representative Mahoney. I think they're good projects. I think they were worthy of support then, and I think the similar projects, whether they're in the metropolitan area or in Greater Minnesota, should be funded. The projects in Greater Minnesota tend to be of smaller of nature, and they don't really make a lot of sense to come up and fight for individual line items. Notice some of the cities, I know of one grant in there that for $25,000. They don't have the for a city of about 208 people, they don't have the staff, they don't have the ability to come up and hire a lobbyist or have a lobbyist on staff to push through an earmark. But it does give them an opportunity for scale back the good things that happen in the Fairland corridor for them to happen in these small communities in greater Minnesota. I don't think that it's a negative comment about the projects that have happened in the metropolitan area. I think they create jobs, and if they have, they're good for the state of Minnesota.
Representative Mahoney.
So, Mr. Dorman, there's not a pot of money other than bringing a bill to the legislature for the metro area. That's correct?
Mr. Dorman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, that's where the original intent was behind this bill, was that large projects get funded, and they probably should. It's not a criticism of them at all. And sometimes I think that people hear us being critical of those programs. We're not. If they're creating jobs, that's a good thing. I think the, again, using the Fairland Corridor as an example, is an example of the state doing good things to help a local community create jobs. I don't know how you could be against, not that you would, but, or anyone could have been against them. This just gives smaller communities that same opportunity.
But Mr. Chair, I guess what I'm trying to get to is that there is no metro pot. I'm not against this particular bill in many particular forms, but I just want the author of the bill to understand that there is no $10 million or $20 million pot that the metro area with a project gets to go apply to deed. They have to come up here for whether it's a $25,000 bill or it's a, you know, a half a billion dollar stadium or a billion dollar stadium, they have to come here and bring a bill. So I just wanted to clear up and make sure that the author of the bill understood this is a separate program.
Representative Franson.
Representative Mahoney, I did not say that they had a separate pot of money. What I said in my opening statements is often similar projects in the metro area of such significance and size that they get a standalone appropriation, which is not often a bad thing.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative Mahoney.
I actually have a another question here. Mr. Dorman, could you explain, earlier you stated that this bill gives deed more flexibility, and I didn't see that unless you're talking about the $2 million. You're going from $1 million to $2 million. Is there a difference in here that I'm not seeing?
Sure. Mr. Dorman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, if you look on page 3.2 towards 3.8, that addresses a cash appropriation. So last year when the legislature funded the program, part with cash and part with bond dollars, deed has to spend them exactly the same way. They don't have the flexibility to spend the cash in a different manner. Because when the program was created, if you think back to when it was created, not only was there limited targets, there were no targets because it was at a time of a deficit. We would have loved cash then, but the only option was bonding, which, as you know, comes with much more restrictions. This does not require deed to spend the dollars any differently. It would just give them the flexibility to do so. It would seem that if the legislature last year and this year does give them cash, we should give them more flexibility to spend those dollars.
Representative Mahoney.
Could I ask Deed to come down and verify that? Because I was under the impression when I, at the last chair, gave them cash twice, they said that they didn't have the same restrictions as the bonding dollars. So I just want to make sure I'm understanding this bill. Because sure. I think $10 million, I think it's a good idea. I think the doubling of the $1 million cost is a good idea. You know, I tried to get that plus more in my bill and it just wasn't there, and my target was a little bit bigger. So I'd just like to know from Deed, though, if she could come down.
Ms. Babine, would you care to come forward again, please? Ms. Babine.
Mr. Chair,
Would you repeat it?
Yes.
Oh, Ms. Babine.
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Dorman said that you were not able to spend cash because you'd gotten cash the last 2 years in the previous chair. unless you spent it in the same fashion as you spent bonding dollars, which can only be on public infrastructure. My understanding, and in this committee I could go back and go through the tapes, but I was pretty sure you said that that would free up, that cash would be free to be able to be used in any manner that the commissioner deemed necessary, so long as you followed the subdivision 4 of 116J 4 something, 431.
Ms. Bavine.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, my understanding is that that is true in some of our programs, like redevelopment and others that have a public or can be used for public or private, and so the public for redevelopment, for example, the public projects can be used with bonds, or bonds can be used for those projects, and we have a little bit more flexibility with the cash. I do not believe that is the case with BDPI because of the public infrastructure nature of it that we would need to use it absent this section. This section would say that we can use it for private uses, but the program itself would still only be able to be used for public infrastructure absent this section or this amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I might be able to help with this. If members look at page 3, to represent Gunther's question on bonding, that was deleted when we deleted section 6. So this was a dual request, but to the point Representative Mahoney brought up, site preparation for properties, for example, an industrial park expansion that a BDPI grant would be used for, bond council had recommended that was not bondable, but cash could be used for things like site prep, demolition of an old shed, and you're doing the dirt work and so forth. So the site prep was specifically mentioned in the cash portion to give that flexibility, which was not bondable under the bonding provisions.
Thank you. Representative Franzen, closing statements?
Members, thank you for your time, and I hope that the chair will grant this in his omnibus bill. I know budgets are tight and numbers are tight, but I'm hopeful for something. So thanks.
Okay. The bill as amended will be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you. Representative McDonald will go next.
I'm not a freshman.
Welcome to the committee. And would Representative Gunther be so kind to move the 2123?
I would be glad to.
2123 is moved to be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Gunther, for moving my bill. Sorry, Representative Swazinski, no treats. I'm not a freshman, but I'll ask Zer Wass for some. Members, imagine, if you will, in your communities, that a business, your local business, maybe a Subway or a Dairy Queen or McDonald's, would have a sign out in front of it that said, sorry, we cannot take credit cards today. Go to the next town. Imagine, if you will, a business that's been in town for many years in your community, your homes, and said, you know what, frankly, we simply cannot do business here because the infrastructure for broadband is not sufficient. We have to move out of town. Imagine, if you will, your hospitals, your businesses, your banks, your schools, not being able to be completely efficient in today's day when it comes to internet service. Going out of business. Imagine the economic loss to your community. You would want something to be done. So, ladies and gentlemen, my bill appropriates $2.4 million for any city that has outages for over 12 hours and very poor broadband infrastructure. I will maintain that cities that have this problem are similar to the city that I have in my home city of Delano. Then each spring, thank God not this spring, the Crow River floods and our town floods. And businesses have to lift up, sandbag, and move out temporarily. Cities that have this problem are flooding. They're drowning. They're losing business. They're losing people, homesteads, families, businesses, and money. So ladies and gentlemen, that is my bill. And to testify just briefly, because I know you have a busy night, is the mayor of one of my cities in my district that hopefully this bill will help. Hopefully it will also help many of other of you who have this problem. Our mayor of Annandale, we call him Dewey. Representative?
Thank you.
Mr. Chair,
mayor, are you interested in replacing the current state representative as he suggested?
Boy, it always seems like whenever you get in a position of elevated stature, it seems like the rookie is the one that always picked to fill a seat, right?
Yeah.
All right.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dwight Gunnarsson, and I am the mayor of the city of Annandale. I would like to thank the committee for the opportunity to tell our story and for considering the proposed bill. Annandale is located approximately 45 miles west of the Twin Cities and 30 miles south of St. Cloud. With being so close to major metropolitan areas, you may be asking, why are we talking about poor internet conditions in Annandale? Are not poor internet issues reserved only for the most rural of the rural? Well, the answer is no. When essentially every community surrounding us has far superior access to broadband, Annandale is truly an island of misfit internet. Years ago, our local telephone company, Lakedale Telephone, was one of the most respected telecommunications companies in Minnesota. Their products and services were cutting edge at the time, and their customer service was impeccable. Their sound business practices kept their customers happy and, more importantly, kept competition out. They had a monopoly, but that was fine because their integrity and service kept us happy. However, in 2008, they were sold to Iowa Telecom, and in 2010, sold again to Windstream Communications based out of Arkansas. That is when it all changed for us. Almost immediately, issues started to arise, and the community quickly realized that we were no longer consumers of a local telecommunications company dedicated to service, but rather a minute segment of population represented as a tiny number on a quarterly profit statement for a mammoth telecommunications conglomerate. It quickly got to the point that our residents and businesses were complaining about slow internet speeds, frequent outages, and high costs. When they were unable to receive satisfactory customer service from Windstream, their default internet help desk and complaint center became City Hall. Our staff literally fielded calls regarding internet, and this continues even today. For almost 4 years now, our community has struggled with our connection to free information and our connection to the rest of the world. For what a majority of Minnesotans take for granted, we struggle with on a constant basis. It has gotten so bad, a number of community members formed a Facebook page called Annandale Needs to Get Rid of Windstream. This page has become an outlet for much frustration and anguish for the community trying to conduct their daily and professional lives in an age of technology. It must be noted that most of the posts on this page are done with mobile devices during our frequent outages. Allow me just to highlight a few but astonishing examples of how Annandale is negatively impacted. According to a post from Robbie Fisher family regarding a recent six-hour outage 6 days ago, April 1st, my son can't do schoolwork, our internet is poor, constantly up. I'm hiring a family lawyer to discuss money that we've been paying for poor service. We're paying for 12 megabyte downloads, but tests indicate that we're only receiving 1 or 2 megabytes. The Annandale Health and Community Services Facility, our elderly care center, often struggles with accessing web-based patient records, and our pharmacies are unable to fulfill prescriptions during outages. Many of our residents telecommute. Eric Monzos writes, our internet finally came back up after some time today.
How does this affect us? Well, it directly takes money out of our pockets and puts my wife's job at risk, not to mention putting her at risk, having to travel when she otherwise wouldn't have to. Subway and Dairy Queen post handwritten messages on the drive-through windows, letting customers know that they are unable to accept credit cards and debit cards. Our car dealerships struggle with online transactions, which are typically time-sensitive. They purchase vehicles via online auctions, and many times they miss sales due to poor internet. The city of Annandale would rather not be involved in providing broadband internet. However, due to our current provider, we were forced to take action. We spent the last 2 years seeking and looking for a big provider to meet our needs and, most importantly, our goals, but they were not interested. Therefore, when a community has a need and the private sector is not interested in providing a solution, then the government needs to step in. So we did. Annandale has demonstrated our passion in becoming a shining light in Minnesota, and Representative McDonald sees that in us. But the only way we are able to be that shining light and succeed in the future is to achieve modern-day broadband infrastructure, which will put us at a level playing field within our own economic geographical area. We can't do it alone. We need the state to support local governments in a similar fashion as you have done with other communities during times of economic challenges. Otherwise, we might as well invest in postage stamps and tin cans and strings. We thank you for the time this evening, and we certainly appreciate any type of consideration and help you may provide. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Any other testifiers you've invited, Representative McDonald?
I do not, Mr. Chair.
All right, this is a public hearing. Are there any other members of the public wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing no public comments, we'll close public comment and move to member questions. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hello, Representative McDonald.
Hello.
I'm all for broadband. Is this a municipal broadband project, then? Who owns the infrastructure? Or who are you proposing on the infrastructure, may I ask?
To
the testifier.
To any of the testifiers?
The guy in the purple shirt. I'm sorry, I missed your name.
Mr. Chair.
Mayor.
The mayor. Sorry, Mayor.
Yep. Thank you for the question. Right now, yes, it would be a municipal-owned project.
Okay. Representative Johnson.
Very good. My main problem with the bill is one that's probably not infrequent here at the Capitol, that being it's a carve-out for a specific city, and we do have a competitive process for these broadband grants that, you know, a set criteria that everyone competes for, and its decisions are made on whatever is the best project. So, you know, that's my only problem with it is, you know, you're carving something out for yourself.
Sorry. Thank you, Representative Johnson. Representative Mahoney.
My only concern here with the bill would be that if it is a municipal broadband infrastructure and you get the carve out for $2.4 million, that you don't turn around and sell it 2 years down the road. So, and there's nothing in the bill that prevents you from doing that. That's a concern that I would have.
Any other questions or comments from members of the committee? Representative Simonson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative McDonald, for bringing this bill forward. And I think, you know, I carried the broadband bill 2 years ago, and I'll tell you that if you accomplish what you set out to accomplish here, I will give you a lot of credit for doing that, because this is the exact type of thing that I would have liked to have accomplished with the bill that we wrote. And I frankly am disappointed that you have to come back here and try this avenue. But I do give you credit for doing that. I think that, Representative Johnson brings up a good point about carve-outs, but I think this is written, you know, sort of vague. So this could apply to a number of places in Minnesota. It's not necessarily one particular one, but I do think that whoever, if there's a city that applies and receives this grant, you know, what they do under this particular language will kind of set the model going forward for the rest of the state, because we have a number of municipalities that are in a very similar boat. And I just want to say, you know, thank you. I think this bill is a good bill. Thanks.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mayor, is that correct?
That's correct.
Was there ever any company that offered to put in broadband into your city?
Mr. Mayor.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, approximately a little bit over a year ago, we did have some interest by a cable company that wished to come in and overbuild Annandale. They wanted to put in their own network on their own terms. We requested if they would be interested in, one, upgrading that network to a fiber-to-the-premise network, and number two, if they would be interested in expanding their service out into the areas of the Annandale community that desperately needed it, a little bit more of the rural areas. That was a year and a half ago, and we're still awaiting their answer on that.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you. I just wanted to know if anybody ever offered to do that. And the fact is they didn't want to go all the way around the lakes, so the density of the customers weren't that great. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we posed two questions to them, and the first one was, would you be interested in upgrading in a fiber build with or without help from the city, and would you be interested in expanding around the lakes? Again, that was a year and a half ago, and we have yet to hear a response from them.
Representative Gunther?
Thank you.
Representative Matissa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll go by any name at this point in this committee.
Well, I got some names for you.
Uh-oh. Maybe I shouldn't have opened that door.
Representative Mahoney is first on deck. Representative Metza, my apologies.
Yeah, careful, Mr. Chair. I have the floor here, Mahoney.
Representative Mahoney, go ahead. Representative Metza, my apologies. I'm done interrupting.
Oh, no worries. I was just curious, Mr. Mayor, did you open it up to non-fiber to the door and have any other options available to those providers that you gave other than just the full fiber build-out?
Mr. Mayor, or is it Dustifiers? Yeah, thanks.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for that question. We had an open RFP process for anyone within the state to provide some sort of proposal in improving our internet situation. We received three requests, and all of them were fiber builds to the home. We did not receive any type of requests outside of fiber to the premise or fiber to the home.
Quick follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so in your request, though, that you said, did you put out a specific ask for fiber as a standalone versus leaving it open to other platforms?
Mr. Mayor.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, absolutely we did. If you're going to do any type of broadband infrastructure, it would be wise and make sense to do a fiber project. That is the only way that you are going to ensure not having to constantly upgrade, and it's the only way that we could ensure not to be in this position ever again.
Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess I'm not clear. You did ask for fiber specifically, or you left it open?
Mr. Mayor.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we certainly encouraged it. We did not have a shall be fiber, but we encourage that the fiber project would be preferable.
Representative Metza?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would just leave it at, you know, I'm supportive of broadband funding in general. I butted heads a little bit with your project over the past session and would encourage you to look at other platforms as well. I don't think that fiber is necessarily, especially over a shorter distance, the be-all, end-all solution. So I just ask you to keep an open mind moving forward with that.
Representative McDonald, any closing comments?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I do. Actually, the grant process that was awarded to broadband last year, or 2 years ago, I guess it was, over 80% of those grantees were fiber to the homes. So this would kind of fall in line with what's already in best practices and it's already been done before. And just keep in mind that this is necessarily, I heard the word carve out, but this, if you read the bill, it's to any city that, as I mentioned in my opening statement, and as our mayor here, Gunderson, mentioned, that has those outages and have those severe broadband deficiencies. So, members, I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I must say you're getting better looking than when I started my hearing here, my comments. No offense, Representative Vogel, where are you?
Too late.
Yeah, he's out of here. Oh, there you are.
Representative Gunther.
Roll call.
Okay. Thank you. With that, Representative Gunther renews his motion to have House File 2123 laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you, Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Representative Murphy, if you want to come down. Oh. And as Representative Murphy's coming down, oh. As Representative Murphy's coming down, for members of the public, I want to kind of give a brief outline for how the chair expects things to go forward this week. First things first is that obviously we're taking testimony. We're laying bills over for possible inclusion today. We'll be doing that same thing tomorrow at our regularly scheduled hearing. It's the chair's intent that at our 6 o'clock hearing, we'll do a walkthrough of the job growth, energy affordability, policy, and finance bill. Spreadsheets and the entire bill will be available. At the completion of that walkthrough, we'll then begin accepting public testimony. Members of the public are not required to, but they may sign up for testimony in advance by contacting the committee legislative assistant for the committee. At that point, at some point, we'll complete public testimony that evening. We will return on Thursday once again where we will take more public testimony. Because the energy article contained within the omnibus bill was released before the Easter break, I would expect that we'd likely see more public testimony on that tomorrow than in other sections. But that being said, there are no restrictions on the content of the bill that people would wish to comment on. So again, comment period begins Wednesday evening. We'll hear it on Thursday. Then on Friday, the committee will reconvene in the basement at noon, where once again we will resume public comment. The deadline for amendments will then be at 2 p.m. that day. And depending upon when public testimony is completed, the committee will then recess to allow the respective caucuses to look at the amendments for markup. And the intent would be that we would return Friday night to mark up and take action on the bill. Now, that being said, if there is still public comment available, there's still public testifiers, the 2 p.m. deadline for amendments would still hold. However, we are not going to begin marking up the bill until there is no longer any public testimony. In the event that Friday night goes too late, we'll return Saturday morning at 8 a.m., where we will, again, either continue public comment or mark up and take action on the bill. If on Saturday, by some chance, we are still taking up public comment at the noon time frame, we will adjourn until Monday morning at 8 a.m., in which we will, again, either continue public comment, mark up the bill, and take action. So the window would be, at its earliest, you can expect markup and action on the bill in this committee on Friday evening. At the latest, you can expect it to be markup and action on the bill Monday evening. That schedule is going to be dictated by the amount of public comment, the amount of amendments submitted, and the availability of information. Are there any questions for members of the committee regarding that schedule? Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you do the walkthrough on Wednesday evening, will you allow member questions for clarification of what the bill actually does before we get to public testimony?
Yeah, Representative Hortman, the chair's intent right now is that we would begin having staff go through article by article, and then we would probably, for a longer article, stop halfway or two-thirds through the way to get clarifying questions, or maybe at the end of the article do that, so that way we don't go through all the articles of the bill and then have to start back at the beginning. Kind of gives staff a chance to kind of rest their voices as well. But that would be the chair's intent, is kind of break that up so it's not interrupting the presentation every 30 seconds, but at the same time, we don't want to have everything bullet through till the end. Representative Hortman.
It's a 63-page policy bill, so I imagine there will be a number of questions for people to understand what's actually happening in the bill.
Well, Representative Hortman, just to be clear, that 63 pages is just part of the bill. We're taking up the complete omnibus bill, so I think I would guess that you're probably looking at about 151 pages of legislative awesomeness on Wednesday night. So,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wortman.
I would have a different descriptor for it. but regardless, I think there will be a lot of questions just to understand what it is you're doing, because I can see that although you haven't struck through the solar energy standard, that you deleted it by saying it can be met by any energy technology. But I'm not sure any member of the public, when they read through the bill, can see that you're repealing it. So those kind of questions, I think, will be important as the walkthrough proceeds.
Yep, and Representative Hartman, not that we want to pre-debate the article, but just to be clear, the section you referenced is actually eligible energy technology. So, for example, Representative Neuberger could not use coal from Sherco to meet the solar standard, but however, if there are more affordable renewable energies or clean energy technologies, those can be used to meet the solar standard. But we won't debate the bill, but your point is very well taken that especially in the area of energy, there's a lot of complex interactions that are going on. There's a lot of, it's a very aggressive reform plan. And so certainly, I think member questions going through that, it's the right thing to do to make sure the public understands not only the language that's on the paper, but also the intent of a majority of the committee. There's been some stuff said out there that just is not factually accurate, and I think sunshine is the best disinfectant, and I certainly agree in that matter. But I think that intent would be that we would kind of break it up into those chunks going through the overview.
Thank you.
Any other questions on the timeline, Representative Mahoney? Nope. Any other questions from members of the committee? Good. Okay. With that, Representative Murphy, do you have someone to move your bill? Representative Simonson moves that House File 1749 be considered for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative Murphy, welcome to the committee. Did you bring treats?
Oh, no.
Yes. Your presence here is a treat for all of us, Representative Murphy.
And
thank you.
Yes, from northern Minnesota.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time and your efforts, and I learned a few things as I was waiting about answers to emails that I've received about landlines and these other things. Anyway, I'm here today and tonight on a pleasurable mission. In 1994, Cirrus came to my neighborhood, uptown, top of the hill, over by the airport, 3 miles from my house. In 1999, Cirrus manufactured their first plane. In this year, they produced 6,000 aircraft. They want to do more, and they have a different model now that they want to expand to. The most exciting thing about Cirrus and their airplanes is that their airplanes have a parachute. And my guests will tell you more about that. But what it's really meant, this is a company that is indeed a 21st century company. It is an alternative to the other industries of northeastern Minnesota, and it is truly a regional company. That being said, we have a new plan to develop another type of aircraft and provide more jobs for the neighborhood, for the city, for the region, for the state of Minnesota, because it is truly a state of Minnesota company. Mr. Bill King is Vice President of the Business Administration at Cirrus, and he is here to tell you a little more about the company. And Dan Fanning is the City of Duluth's representative that's here to speak for the city. Please listen.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you very much, Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Bill King. I am Vice President of Administration and Development at Cirrus Aircraft up in Duluth, and it's our honor to be here today. The purpose of the legislation that's before you is to assist sort of a cooperative venture, if you will, between the city and the state and the company to expand our growth and help us in developing space sufficient for us to continue to manufacture in Duluth. The site, the project specifically, is designed to utilize what is a very difficult site for manufacturing, and in fact, it actually isn't even technically right on the same space or the same area of the airport. It's actually across a county road, believe it or not. So we are literally now looking at developing a site that's adjacent to the airport, and we're excited about doing that. It provides space sufficient for us to expand and grow, to create a space for finishing and completing our aircraft as we complete the manufacturing process. What this does for us is it provides us an opportunity to move our completion center as we now have it into a different building, because the building we're currently in is not sized sufficiently to accommodate our larger aircraft that we're just completing. About the end of this year, about the end of 2015, we will certify a project called the SF-50 Vision Jet, which is a small private jet-powered aircraft, and it expands our reach into the next level, if you will, of general aviation. As Representative Murphy just mentioned, this next month, actually, we'll be delivering our 6,000th aircraft, all produced and delivered in northeastern Minnesota, right in Duluth, and we're proud of that. We're hometown guys. We're excited about this expansion and what this means. This isn't a theoretical expansion. This actually does generate additional jobs, and by the time we're done with our 2015 development plan, relocating a couple of divisions elsewhere, moving some pieces around, what this actually ends up generating is an additional 150 jobs in Duluth. Interestingly, and this may not be obvious to anybody but in the metro area, but up in our area, our reach actually goes all the way up just past Eveleth. We got employees that drive down all the way from Eveleth, people that drive in from Maple, Wisconsin, down near the Sandstone area, and all the way over actually east or west past Floodwood. So we've got a huge reach, and this will generate an additional 150 jobs. We're excited about that. Anybody that's ever been through our plant knows that the jobs that we have are our primary wage-earning jobs. The environment within which we work is second to none. We're a very highly regulated industry. In order to maintain our Federal Aviation Administration certifications that allow us the privilege to build the aircraft and sell them to the public, we actually have a number of inspections that take place every 6 months and a major inspection that takes place every 18 months. And we've never had a finding under any category that qualified as a major finding of any type, which is essentially unheard of in our industry. So we're very proud of our workforce. Consequently, we take very good care of our employees. We pay well. We take good care of our employees. Our expansion will certainly further that effort, and we're very happy about being before you tonight. The space that we're talking about utilizing up until this point, you might be interested in knowing, was actually its highest and best use. I think we would all look back in history and realize it was a ball diamond in a federal prison. So we think this is a better use for the property, and we're excited about that and what it generates, and we'd be more than happy and honored to take any questions that you might have.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Daniel Fanning. I oversee government relations for the city of Duluth, and on behalf of the city and Mayor Ness, thank you for this opportunity. A special thanks to Representative Murphy and Representative Simonson for your leadership on this. Essentially exactly what Mr. King just echoed. In the interest of saving time, I'll just say not only do we agree, but we fully concur with everything he said and take it a step farther. A few weeks ago when we announced this, Mayor Ness was proud and honored to join leadership of CIRRUS, because CIRRUS has been such a tremendous community partner. Not only are they one of the biggest and best employers, not only in Duluth, but in the entire region, they're also one of the best community partners. And in fact, just the most recent magazine that the Chamber of Commerce put out highlighted the work that they do in the community and what they mean to the economic value and the job growth in our region. And we know that the aviation sector is a huge reason for the economic growth in our city, and we also know that CIRRUS is really leading that, and that has led us to a new airport, that has led us to expansions in AAR and other aviation sectors, and we are thankful for CIRRUS's leadership and fostering a lot of that development. So just on behalf of the city, I just want to be here with strong support with them, and thank you again for this opportunity.
Thank you. Representative Murphy, do you have any other invited testifiers?
No.
This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion. Before we go to member questions, Ms. Newman, can you just provide a very, very brief overview of what the Minnesota Investment Fund is so members of the committee are can refresh the recollection of that?
Mr. Chair and members, the Minnesota Investment Fund provides loans which may be forgiven or grants to businesses in Minnesota. It was funded last biennium at a level of $15 million a year, and that's an ongoing base appropriation. The grant limit is currently $1 million per recipient, and the loans cannot be more for more than 50% of the capital costs of any project. Projects that are funded through MIF money have to meet job creation. There are wage goals, job enhancement goals, and those are all stipulated in agreements that are entered into by the recipient of the money. And the commissioner has the ability to delay or pull back funds if those agreements are breached or in danger of being breached. And as I said, the loan may be forgiven. And this bill does in lines 12 through 15 stipulate that there is the loan forgiveness, but that the loan is not subject to that $1 million limitation that is currently in the law.
Questions from members of the committee? Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, this is for Ms. Newman. On line 1.12, it says a loan is not subject to the limitations under 116J, subdivision 5, I believe. What is subdivision 5?
Representative Clark, that's the $1 million limit on the grant. Okay. And this bill asks for it's a $4 million loan.
Okay. Any other questions from members of the committee? Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Parachutes? You're going to explain.
Mr. King.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Neuberger, thank you for asking. For those of you who had benefit of noticing the news about 2 months ago, there was a pilot that was flying from actually taking one of our aircraft, delivering it to Australia. As luck would have it, it was one of ours. And when I say ours, I mean the company still owned it. It was on its way to an air show, and it was being ferried over the Pacific Ocean. In order to go that far, there's very few options for landing in the Pacific Ocean. So that means that we had to put a ferry tank in it, which is 80 gallons of additional fuel. The company that did that apparently put in a defective valve. The aircraft wasn't able to refuel in the air, and the pilot was going to be 150 miles short of the Maui coastline. What he then did was get in a cell phone, a satellite phone, communicate with the company that installed the unit, and realized he's going to go for a swim, which, generally speaking, in aviation is a bad outcome. So he realized he was going to end up in the ocean, advised the Maui, the Coast Guard of Maui, and they came out, advised him where there happened to be in the area a cruise ship. Flew over, met up with the cruise ship. Worked with the captain closely to make sure that he was far enough away, and deployed his parachute. Every aircraft that we manufacture comes equipped with a ballistic recovery systems parachute manufactured right into the aircraft. Actually, another Minnesota company out of South St. Paul down at Fleming Field. A neat process. And we are the only certified aircraft that was certified with that as a primary safety device, and they are installed in all of our aircraft. The pilot deployed the canopy. The aircraft came down the ocean, he jumped out on the wing, jumped in a life raft, the aircraft then subsequently sank, and the lifeboat from the cruise ship came over and picked him up, and he spent the next day and a half lounging on a cruise ship, enjoying himself, and which we accused him of having a cheap way of getting on board a cruise ship. That notwithstanding, system has been deployed 53 times and responsible for saving 105 lives, including a number of mid-air collisions and pilot incapacitations and stuff that actually happens. It's rare, but it happens. And we're very proud of that, and that has yielded an incredible safety record that is significantly below the general aviation statistics worldwide. And we are very proud, again, to have that be another Minnesota company, and we're proud of what we develop and build. To answer the question in anticipation, the jet will also have a parachute on board. It's just bigger and a lot more expensive. So, but we're excited about that product and the project, and it has we have the safest airplane in our class, bar none. Those types of events are very often, if not almost always, fatal. And had he continued on, he would have been 150 miles short instead of 250, and meeting up with the ship, he would have been 150 miles short. And for benefit of anybody that doesn't know this, there aren't helicopters that will go 150 miles loiter and be able to pick him up. So he would have had to have they had to wait for ages to go out and try and find him in a boat because the helicopter was not an option for him. So his life was certainly in peril, and he certainly attributes it to saving his life. Amazing. We're very proud of that.
Good technology. Good job. Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question regards is regarding the line 111, the provision prohibiting labor organization its members from engaging in any picketing, work stoppage, or boycotts. How does that work when a bargaining group, when you do a contract, I'm assuming it's a multi-year contract, what happens if at the end of that bargaining group, there isn't an agreement? I'm surprised that you can compel them with one contract into future years.
Representative Lunan, that is an amendment to the bill, which I believe we're going to go to Representative Simonson on now, and he's going to discuss the amendment. That is not the bill. It has not been amended onto the bill. So,
okay.
Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to, at this time, offer the A15-0202 for consideration.
Representative Simonson moves the A15-0202 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and a couple of things before I try to explain what's in this amendment. And I just want to, you know, get some facts out there before we get too deep in the weeds. But first thing I want to say is that I'm very appreciative of Cirrus and their efforts in our community. They, as has been stated by both Representative Murphy and Mr. Fanning, they are a shining example of an outstanding employer in our city, and I'm very appreciative of that and the product that they offer, and I think that they are a stellar example of what happens when we can diversify within our communities. So thank you for that. And this amendment, Mr. Chair and members, is not an anti-Cirrus amendment. This really has nothing to do with the employer that's seeking the appropriation in this case. The second clarification that I want to make is that what you see here in front of you in this amendment is not a project labor agreement, which it oftentimes is confused with because it's similar language. But I would say on the record that both Cirrus and the City of Duluth have been very supportive of project labor agreements in the past and certainly will be in the future, I'm sure. So we don't have any concerns in that particular area. This particular amendment is what's known as a labor peace agreement, and you may have heard some discussion about this. We've talked about this for a couple of years. Maybe you have in years prior to that, too. But essentially what it is it's designed to be another level of protection for both the state's investment, in this case the direct appropriation of $4 million, as well as the region's investment. The City of Duluth has a stake in the game. Cirrus themselves have money in the game, and as such, I think the region and the taxpayers in the region have a vested interest in seeing this project go forward without disruption. So this particular language is not uncommon. It may be, you know, new to some of us to look at, to try to include in a provision such as this to offer some protections. But I'm bringing it forward today, Mr. Chair, with the intent of just having a discussion about, you know, the potential for further protections for state investments going forward in unique projects. And I think that we all can agree that this is unique, and although a worthwhile project, it is somewhat unique. And essentially what it does is that the appropriation would not be available until an agreement would have been entered into between the employer of workers constructing the aircraft in the facility, in other words, employers of Cirrus, and any labor organization seeking to represent those workers. Now, there's no guarantee that there's going to be a labor organization seeking to represent. So by including this language, you know, nobody might ever be the wiser. This money could be appropriated, the facility built, and the state's process concluded, and all things going forward, nobody would even know that it happened. But in the event that we do have a labor organization that would seek to represent, this agreement essentially prohibits any picketing or work stoppages or boycotts or anything else that would have an economic interference with the employer's operation. So essentially it is just that, Mr. Chair, members. It's a labor peace agreement. And I don't know if there's folks in the audience that wish to testify or this or not, but that's the amendment.
Thank you. The members of the public wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the amendment? Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Brad Leto from the Minnesota AFL-CIO, the Chief of Staff of the Minnesota AFL-CIO. And first I want to say that contrary to some people's belief, we do like employers in the state of Minnesota, union and non-union, because without employers, there are no jobs. So I want to say that first off. But I am here this evening to support Representative Simonson's amendment for the bill authorizing $4 million from the Minnesota Investment Fund for Cirrus, U.S. subsidiary of Aviation Industry of America Corporation of China. While the total project is estimated at slightly over $10 million, according to what I've read, public money would account for $8 million, $4 million from the state and $4 million from the city of Duluth. It is important, we believe, that the legislature protects the public interest in its $4 million financial investment in the project. It is likewise important that the Commissioner of the Employment and Economic Development Department enter into an agreement to ensure the conditions of the Minnesota Statute of the Minnesota Investment Fund 116J871 are met and exceeded as the limit of $1 million is being exceeded. There's a lot of provisions, as Council mentioned, in the Minnesota Investment Fund. There's a lot of discussion on private sector jobs being created, provided at a higher wage, improving the quality of existing jobs based on increases in wages. In the eligible projects clauses 3 and 5 state the project can demonstrate that investments of public dollars induces private funds. And I only just question if 20% is the right amount, but I'm not going to say it is or isn't. And also in clause 5, the project provides higher wage levels to the community. On this question of higher wage levels to the community, it is important that the Commissioner of Deed ensure this to be the case. In subdivision 5 of the investment fund language of the statute, the last sentence states, persons or entities receiving grants or loans must pay each employee total compensation, including benefits not mandated by law, that on an annualized basis is equal to at least 110% of the federal poverty level for a family of 4, unquote. Is this even enough? In the 2015, 110% of poverty amounts to $26,675. At 2,000 annual work hours, this amounts to $13.34 per hour. And that includes, and that what it says in the statute is wages and benefits and all of that combined. In the Department Economic Development 2015 Minnesota Cost of Living Study is required by the Minnesota Statutes 116J013. The living wage in the Arrowhead region, and it doesn't break it down between Duluth and the Iron Range region, for a family of 3, 2 adults and 1 child is $13.96 per hour. That's to meet the basic needs of health care, child care, food, housing, transportation, and other necessities.
Hold on 1 second.
Not yet.
Did it reset? Sorry.
No, I certainly hope it wasn't on purpose just for me.
Hey, trust me.
I'm only trying to make the bill more awesome, Mr.
Hey, trust me. If I had a remote control, I would have used it a long time ago.
I'm just about. Yeah.
Not for you. I mean, like, in this committee. Not. So please continue with your testimony.
The other thing is that I'm not sure if, quite honestly, if Cirrus provides health care, but at $13.96, the figure in the cost of living study includes $3.93 per month for healthcare, $47.16 a year. If that is deducted from the gross wage, that would amount to $10.98 per hour. So, without knowledge of what's provided, The real point, though, is that of all of this, is that the Commissioner of Deed, we believe, should enter into an agreement with Cirrus as outlined in Representative Simonson's amendment in order to protect the financial interests of Minnesota. In lieu of that, certainly other disclosures could be done from the current business subsidy law that exists on the books. Thank you for the time tonight. I know it's getting late to address the amendment. If you have questions, I can certainly address them.
Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the amendment to the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion on the amendment to the bill. Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I think Mr. Leto makes some good points, and I think, you know, the language that's before us, I believe, is solid, good language. I know that there's still some work that we can do to perhaps make this more palatable. And I think over the next several hours, as you work to put together your omnibus bill, and I know there's no guarantee that this comes back before us, but in the event that it does, perhaps there's another opportunity to take a look at it. But with that, Mr. Chair, in the event of the hour, and I appreciate the committee's indulgence, I will withdraw the amendment.
Thank you. Any other comments from members of the committee? Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, this is really a question for staff, and you may have spoken to it. I just didn't hear it. Under the Job Creation Fund and the MIF funds, there are substantial clawbacks. Is this $4 million subject to the clawbacks that are in that particular language?
Ms. Newman?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, yes, it would
Thank you.
Be.
Representative Mahoney? Representative Murphy, any closing comments?
Mr. Chair, I really appreciate your time. You've given us some things to think about, and I will leave it in your hands. I hope it's in the bill.
Thank you. Representative Simonson renews his motion to have House File 1719 laid over for possible 1749 laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative Murphy and the testifiers, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Garofalo, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, I would move House File 2081 for possible inclusion in a later bill.
And Representative Garofalo, is this your DE2 amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair, I would move the DE2 amendment to get the bill in the form that I would like.
All right. Discussion on the DE2 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the DE2, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The DE2 is before us. Go ahead, Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. What House File 2081 is an attempt to recognize some emerging technology that's taking place in the area of automobiles. House File 2081, as amended, does two things. Number one, it sets up a rebate incentive program for zero-emission vehicles, commonly referred to as electric vehicles. Second of all, it also sets up a rebate program for compressed natural gas vehicles with a specific focus on those vehicles that are running some of the most dirty fuel that are currently in our environment. Those are diesel. And so the EV portion is for rebates on vehicles only. However, in the compressed natural gas section, you will see that there are rebates for newly purchased vehicles. There are conversions from diesel to compressed natural gas. And it's open up to businesses, whereas the EVs are for just homeowners. I should say that the electric vehicle rebate program is limited to the Excel service territory. Without going into specific details, the 116C.779 provision, you'll see that we're creating a new fund called the Energy Fund Account. There are multiple sources of revenue that will come into that that we'll be discussing when the omnibus bill is revealed tomorrow. But the advantages of EV vehicles are best served on a pilot basis as opposed to going on a system-wide basis. We want to make sure that it's in those areas where we're going to get the biggest bang for the buck, highest density populations, and that matches up well with the Xcel service territory. In addition, of the proceeds that are going into the energy fund account, there is a disproportional amount of money coming from Xcel ratepayers as opposed to statewide taxpayers, so we wanted to account for that. With that, I have some additional testifiers here which testify to the benefits of compressed natural gas as well as electric vehicles, and I'm happy to invite those testifiers up right now.
All right. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, if you would, and go ahead with your comments.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brendan Jordan. I'm with the Great Plains Institute. I'm here today representing the Drive Electric Minnesota Partnership. Drive Electric Minnesota is the state's plug-in vehicle coalition. We include automakers, auto dealers, electric utilities, local governments, the environmental community, and importantly, plug-in vehicle owners. Gasoline is about an $8 billion market in Minnesota. You're talking about, you know, per capita expenditures for fuel on the order of $2,300. If we wanted to have a $25 million impact, reducing $25 million in state expenditures, all we would need to do is put 15,000 electric vehicles on the road, representing less than 0.5% of total vehicles. And this rebate program would accomplish that goal and more. We believe electric vehicles are an important component of an energy efficient and cleaner transportation system in Minnesota that is both financially and environmentally sustainable. Advancing electric vehicle deployment will have many benefits to Minnesotans, including reduced transportation costs, cleaner air, and energy independence. Just for a few examples on the clean air side, electric vehicles are 3 to 4 times more energy efficient than internal combustion vehicles. They have zero emissions from the tailpipe. Thus, any emission associated with conventional vehicles is going to be helped by electric plug-in vehicles. They can directly use renewable electricity under programs in existence. Drive Electric Minnesota has a policy committee. We've made two major recommendations for the state of Minnesota, and this rebate program addresses one of them. If we want to look at other states that have really kind of moved the needle on increasing adoption of this new technology, those are states that have offered rebate programs. We have 18 states that have done that, and we have seen a lot of benefit. It's clear that the policy works. We don't think that this is a policy that needs to be in place forever. Eventually, the costs are going to come down. So this is sort of a program to kind of jumpstart adoption of this technology. We'd like to offer our sincere thanks to Chair Garofalo for taking the lead on this initiative. And we share his excitement about this technology. And I think there's a lot of other folks in the room that share that excitement as well. Madam Chair and members, again, I really appreciate the opportunity to address the committee and show support for this provision. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jordan. What I'd like to do next is just have the next testifier go ahead and give his testimony. That's all right. Yeah. Go ahead and state your name for the record, please.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jukka Kukkonen, and I'm representing here Minnesota Plug-in Vehicle Owners Circle members, so owners of electric vehicles and drivers. Here in Minnesota.
Sir, would you mind spelling your last name, please?
My surname is K-U-K-K-O-N-E-N.
Thank you.
Typical Finn, Madam Chair.
Yes. So, Minnesota electric vehicle owners would like to see more people driving electric. The reality is that we need to wean ourselves off of oil as quickly as possible, and electric vehicles provide us the great way to do that. What we already heard is that electric vehicles are 3 to 4 times more efficient than traditional car, and you should find this kind of slide in your packages there that kind of gives an idea about that one. This is a average fuel economy for new vehicles sold from 75 to last year, and if you look at the lowest line there, that's a blue line. That's an internal combustion engine. You can see that the numbers have not changed too much. Miles per gallon has stayed pretty similar over the years, even though we have been talking about all kinds of improvements. Whereas hybrids came in the market 2002, you can see a much bigger jump there in efficiency. And then we see the electric vehicles, over 100 miles per gallon on average there. So we can see why this is important technology, both in energy efficiency-wise and from emission standpoint. So that's what I have this one for. But in addition to being more efficient, electric vehicles are also really, really fun to drive. Everyone who has shifted to driving electric says it's one of the best decisions of their life, and they are never going back. Just this year, 3,000 Minnesota plug-in vehicle owners will drive over 20 million gas-free miles. And for example, in our family, we have driven about 26,000 electric miles in the last 2.5 years. And electric vehicles are kind of like a LED lighting. A couple of years ago, many people were still saying that they want to stick with the old light bulbs. But now when people have tried new LEDs and realized how well new technology works and how big energy savings are, people are starting to shift to new technology. Same will happen with electric cars in many ways for the same reasons. We just need to encourage people to try out the new technology. And Minnesota plug-in vehicle owners are very supportive of efforts to provide real-life information about electric vehicles to people and incentivize the shift to driving electric. So thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee. Go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Amber Backus, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association and its 367 franchise new car and truck dealers in Minnesota. And thank you to Representative Garofalo for bringing forward House File 2081 and its approach to incentivizing consumers to purchase electric vehicles. This is still an emerging market, as electric vehicles comprise only 0.2% of the vehicles registered in Minnesota in 2012. The two primary barriers to ownership are range and price, with EVs costing on average $10,000 to $15,000 more than the comparable conventional vehicle. States that have provided incentives to purchase cleaner EVs along the line of what's included in House File 2081 have seen sales of 2 to 4 times the national average. And why would we want to incent the purchase of electric vehicles? While emissions from mobile sources have dropped significantly over the past 10 years, gas and diesel vehicles are the biggest source of pollutants like NOx and VOCs that contribute to ground-level ozone. By increasing the state electric vehicle fleet by 4,000 vehicles, as this bill proposes to do, we can expect to see reductions in NOx of 144 tons, in VOCs of 120 tons, and in greenhouse gases of 14,850 tons. Encouraging Minnesotans to drive zero-emission electric vehicles with this incentive will further curb pollutants to keep Minnesota from becoming a non-attainment area, a consequence that would cost consumers and businesses hundreds of millions of dollars more than the incentives provided in this bill. I think the figure for Minnesota would be $240 million annual to comply if we were a non-attainment area by having things like reformulated gasoline at the pump, which on average costs 18 to 20 cents more per gallon. And for the first time since electric vehicles came on the market, Minnesota did see a 10% drop in purchase of them in 2014, making this an opportune time to institute an electric vehicle rebate program. That concludes my testimony, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Backus. And Representative Garofalo, just a quick question. Would you say that Ms. Backus' testimony regarding electric vehicles being approximately $10,000 to $15,000 more than the average vehicle is accurate in your experience?
I think it depends upon the vehicle that you're comparing it to.
Let's compare it to, say, a Tesla.
Comparing it to what then?
Let's say a Toyota.
I would say it's an inaccurate statement.
And would you say that number should be higher or lower, her estimate?
Again, there's a lot of variables that could play into that in terms of the features, the models, and
what
currency you're using. And I can dodge questions better than you, Madam Chair.
All right, very fine. Welcome to the next testifier. Go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is John Williams. I'm the manager of commercial industrial sales for CenterPoint Energy. And we appreciate the opportunity to testify here before you tonight, and we appreciate Chair Garofalo's leadership on this issue. We represent a coalition of companies that are interested in natural gas vehicles for fueling and transportation. The Centerpoint Energy, CNG Innovations Minnesota, Quick Trip, McNeilus Companies, Integris, Merck, and Trillium, Wendel Companies, Xcel Energy, and Zero Res. And in addition to that, there is also several, about 30 to 40 other organizations that have been members of a NGV coalition over the last couple of years that has been sponsored by the American Lung Association of Minnesota through a DOE grant that they have. And what I'm going to testify quickly on is why natural gas is really a good fuel to consider for transportation. Natural gas is domestic, it's economical, it's clean, it's abundant, there's over a 100-year supply, it's reliable and safe. I'm going to talk specifically here about emissions. Natural gas is the cleanest fossil fuel. It produces less greenhouse gases than diesel. As an example, for heavy-duty vehicles, it emits 20 to 30% less. For light duty, it's 26 to 29%. It also reduces carbon monoxide emissions by approximately 70 to 90%. It reduces carbon dioxide emissions by 20 to 30%. Reduces nitrogen oxide emissions, by 75 to 90%, which contributes to less smog, soot, and soot and petroleum fuels, emits little or no particulate matter, which is really important because that is one of the items that can help prevent or minimize non-attainment in this area, which if that comes to this area, would be very expensive. And when I say this area, actually would be specific areas within the state of Minnesota. So natural gas can help meet state environmental emissions initiatives, and it can offer more price stability and less volatility than some other vehicle fuels. And we feel that utilizing natural gas as a vehicle fuel is good public policy. I appreciate your time and appreciate your willingness to consider this. And I can answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. I believe we have another testifier. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tony Kellen. I am a business development consultant with Wendel Companies, which has an office in Minneapolis, and we are a designing architectural and engineering firm that works in the compressed natural gas market and have for a little over 20 years. So I'm just testifying today in support of these rebates, and I appreciate our author, Representative Garofalo's work so far on this. We're very supportive of the vehicle rebates and the rebate amounts. We're very happy to see the $5 million in there in both of those years. We do have some technical things that we would like to see changed in the bill, but I don't know if you would like Representative Garofalo to go through those at all today or if...
Representative Garofalo?
Madam Chair, to testify that if they're technical modifications, then it probably best is to submit it in writing.
Sure. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Then what I'll do is I'll just do a very, very high level. We just want to work with the definitions. There are some misconceptions on diesel fuel and conversions and what the definitions for a new vehicle or a converted vehicle that we'd like to look at. Some of the vehicle weight limits need some work. We also would like to see a little broader application of the businesses that can actually take advantage of this. We think municipalities, counties, school districts should potentially have an opportunity to do this too. A few things on EPA. There are options for compliant conversions as compared to certified compliant kits. So, and again, we have been working with Chair Garofalo on this, and we have submitted some of those things to him, and we understand that he's looking at those. So, again, just very supportive of seeing this and very thankful that we've had the opportunity to take a look at this.
Great. Thank you for your testimony. We've got a long list here. How many more? Are there any other people in the audience that wish to testify? Are you folks planning to stick around for the remainder of the hearing on the bill? Okay, for questions later? Great. Okay. Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? If not, then we will go. Oh, we have another person. Okay. Please come forward. Thank you. Please have a seat, and welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, and go ahead with your testimony, please.
Madam Chairman, I'm Roger Leiter, Executive Director of the Minnesota Propane Association, and I'm here to talk about the bill and maybe some concerns that we have with this. One of the first things that we'd like to say is that we are pro-natural gas, we're pro-electricity, and we're pro-alternate fuel vehicles. The thing that we have concern with is that if we're going to do this, all the alternate fuel vehicles need to be included in this bill. If we're going to move Minnesota forward with 30,000 vehicles by 2020, which the original bill had listed as a goal, it's going to take all of us together to move and do that. We feel that it's important that all of us be treated on an equal basis, and this bill does not have propane in it at this time. Propane shares the exact same clean emission profile that natural gas does, and there's many vehicles in the state of Minnesota already running on propane. Propane's the leading alternate fuel in the world and in the United States. There's more alternate fuel vehicles on propane than anything else. Behind diesel and natural gas, more vehicles are fueled worldwide with propane than anything else. Not including propane, we believe, would severely limit the alternate fuel choices for outstate Minnesota, and it would severely restrict what would happen to local communities, police departments, sheriff departments, school districts who are converting to propane-powered buses. They would not have the same opportunity that the natural gas people would have at this time. We would move or hope that we could see an inclusion of propane someplace within this. We had offered a bill, House File 2020, that called for propane awards as well. We have not seen a hearing on this yet, but we'd like to see some movement on that. With me also today is a representative, Mark Grave of Federated Co-ops, who has alternate fuel vehicles, fuels them, and works in the field with this. I'd like to have him an opportunity to speak to the issue.
Great. Welcome to the committee. Go ahead and state your name for the record and continue.
Thank you. I'm Mark Grave. In addition to being propane, I'm a 20-year volunteer firefighter, and I think I can tell you I'm more comfortable being in my turnout gear at burning building than I am speaking publicly, so please bear with me. But I've been driving a propane vehicle since 1990, back when the carbureted models, and I still drive a 2012 Chevy Tahoe on propane today. And I'm asking that propane be included on this for a couple reasons, mainly for rural Minnesota. I would not have the range to drive a natural gas or electric vehicle. I started in Kettle River this afternoon on my way down. Those two options do not provide me the range I need to drive here and back home. They also don't provide the range for a school bus to drive down to the state tournament and back. Propane is clean. Roger kind of stole my thunder a little bit, but you'd be surprised what it can be used for. I've got a propane ice auger, got a propane motorcycle, got a propane lawnmower. It is the emissions mirror natural gas. And like Roger said, we are pro-natural gas. We are pro-electric. I do have to toss one thing out there as far as misleading the committee goes. The next person that says an electric car is zero emissions kind of chokes me up a little bit. They must have never lived next to a coal-fired power plant. So maybe zero in your backyard, not in mine. So we're all in this together. I'm not opposed to this bill if we could change it a little bit. Why could we take the number three motor fuel in the world and eliminate it for Minnesotans? I would like the chance myself to partake in this. Where the funding comes from, I guess you can be opposed to that or for that, because it really doesn't matter. If you yank the money from a power plant or from CenterPoint or whoever, we all pay a little bit for it, but I'm all for affordable clean energy, and propane is a vital part of that picture, and I feel remiss that it's not in the bill. Feel honored to be here, and I thank you for your hard work, but this is incomplete, guys. We need a hand. Too short Minnesotans on the number three fuel for their automobiles is a travesty. And certainly I'm not a professional speaker or hired gun, but, you know, geez, I can see this. We've got some work to do. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Grave. So it looks like someone else has come to the testifiers table. Please introduce yourself and go on to the testimony.
My name is Brian Ragor. I'm with Como Oil and Propane out of Duluth, Minnesota. I'm also part of the Alliance Autogas Network, which is a conglomeration of propane companies across the United States, where our main goal is to convert vehicles to run on propane. My direct job is to actually work with companies in Minnesota. I cover the entire state of Minnesota to help school districts, police departments, sheriff's departments, transportation companies reduce their emissions and reduce costs of their fuel. I am asking that we include propane on this. I will tell you I have driven an electric vehicle. I've driven a Tesla. Favorite car I've ever driven. It's an amazing car. So I support the natural gas and the electric, but I do request that we add propane to this also.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Anyone else in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, we will move to committee questions. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, thank you, testifiers. I know that I think this bill is from Representative Garofalo is a great bill. It's almost perfect. In fact, again, I think the testimony was very compelling tonight, and I'm maybe going to ask the question, Representative Garofalo, is there a reason we did not add propane tonight to this bill?
Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Baker, as we've said before, the focus of the committee is to be on both cleaner and cheaper energy sources. And in the areas of converting from gas mobiles to electric vehicles, that standard is met. And when we convert from diesel vehicles to natural gas, that standard is met. With regards to propane, it is certainly the case can be made that it is cleaner than diesel. It certainly can be made that case. But if you look at the EIA data, you'll see that when it comes to CO2 emissions, actually natural gas is substantially cleaner than propane. In addition, there is volatility in propane pricing that we've seen over the last couple of years. Propane is a more volatile energy in terms of pricing, has a more volatile pricing stream than does natural gas. And so for those reasons, I've chosen not to include it in this bill.
Madam Chair.
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Garofalo for that so-so answer. I guess what I'm wondering is, it's much cleaner than diesel, which you've admitted. I appreciate that. But I think what also was compelling to me was the range of the propane vehicles, the large vehicles. I know that I've had several conversations back in my district and in greater Minnesota about the bus garages and the folks that want to use this good bill to do some more propane work. So, again, I'm hoping that when the amendments deadlines are there, that we can talk a little bit more about marking up this bill and adding what I think is a good viable fuel like propane. Again, I think if you recall, some months ago we had good conversations. Fuel like propane. Again, I think if you recall, some months ago we had good conversations about finding new ways of making propane less volatile with the market, with some buying programs and purchasing. So I'm hoping that you'll be open to that conversation, and maybe we can hear from others as well. But I think it's a very good idea, and I hope that we can look at propane as being part of this bill, Representative Garofalo.
Representative Garofalo, do you have a response to that?
Madam Chair, Representative Baker, to be clear, if you had come to me 10 or 15 years ago for a bill to incentivize natural gas vehicles, I would have said, no, it's not a good idea. But there's been a change. There's been a change in American energy policy, a game changer, and that is the fracking revolution that we're seeing take place across the country, where now there's an abundance of natural gas. Now, propane conversion vehicles have taken place for many years. It was actually, as a testifier mentioned, I believe back in the early 80s, there was sort of a trend to convert to propane. But the reality is that sort of disruptive technology from fracking has not made its way into the propane marketplace yet. The natural gas infrastructure is in place. To the contrary, we're seeing, because of the narrow scope of propane, it's not as widely utilized as natural gas, that, in fact, I don't think it would be a good idea. As with any policy, I mean, members can always offer amendments and they can advocate for it, but that's where I stand. And I would suspect that it would be a close vote, but a majority of the committee may agree with me.
Representative Baker, any follow-up?
Yes, one follow-up, if I could, Madam Chair. And again, I think that as I've, again, living in greater Minnesota, I see a lot of ability for propane to continue to expand in a new era of propane with all the new gas that we are getting out of the ground. And again, I see a lot of distribution centers that we can use to fill the buses, and again, I see larger vehicles. I see this as a real plus for Greater Minnesota. So again, as we work through this process and work through the amendments, I do ask the the committee to maybe consider this. If I were to add an amendment later on, I do hope that you would consider this, and I'll work hard to make sure this is part of the best bill possible. So I appreciate that, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Representative Baker. Anyone else to the point of propane Representative Lunan, you were next on the list regarding this topic. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a topic that I was contacted by several members in my district. And when I looked at the bill and actually the lack of role that propane played in what we're trying to accomplish or what it looks like this bill is trying to accomplish, it doesn't seem like it was very thought out, omitting that. And I would hope that going forward that that gets remedied in the process when we're marking up the bill. I do believe that it does play a role, and I think there's actually benefits that propane offers that some of the other alternative energies do not offer. I don't know if I necessarily agree that whether something's included or not is an all-in or all-out, that there's a spectrum of benefits here, and that if, in fact, it improves on the situation we have right now, that we should give it a hard look.
Thank you, Representative Lunan. Representative Garofalo, a response?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Lunan, what did you mean by not well thought out?
Well, when you take a look at alternative energies, sorry, Madam Chair, when you take a look at alternative energies, and this was actually, this dawned on me when I looked at the bill, but then I was contacted by several people who basically had the same summation that propane would obviously belong on the list.
Representative Garofalo.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Luna, when you say well thought out, is it the part about natural gas being cleaner than propane? That's the part that's not well thought out? Or is it the fact that natural gas is cheaper than propane? Propane, is that not well thought out?
Representative Luna.
No, thank you, Madam Chairman. No, the fact that the situation that we're trying to improve with these alternative energies, that propane obviously is on that list. It's just a matter of to what degree. I don't have the data, but it would more or less make the cut.
Representative Garofalo? No. Okay, next, was that it, Representative Lunan?
Yep, thank you, Madam Chair.
Next on this topic, Representative Spadzinski.
Thank you, Chair Scott. Appreciate that. I just want to reiterate really what kind of the line of that Representative Baker was taking with this. You know, when it comes to industry, and I think I represent a large food manufacturer in my district, Schwan's Foods, that's schwansfoods.com, and
promote them unless you pass out free ice cream sandwiches.
You'll have your opportunity for that, Representative
Thank
Scott.
You.
And not tonight. But, I think I agree that, this opportunity to, I understand, Representative Chair Garofalo, your assertion about cleanliness and availability and price. But I think, when we look at options and we look at broad spectrum, if this portion was happened to make it into any bills that would be come before us in the future, it would be my hope that we could leave this open to the consumers and what direction that they would feel potentially would benefit them from their transportation decisions. So with that, I would thank you.
Representative Newberg, I believe you had one follow-up question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Garofalo, I have a question for you. The original goal of this bill was to, you're looking to add 30,000 new electric cars. How many megawatts of energy are you going to need to facilitate that that new demand?
Representative Garofalo, you're doing the math in your head?
No, Madam Chair and Representative Neuberger, while the original bill called for a goal of 30,000 EVs, it's not how the bill was crafted as part of the Delete All Amendment. What it would do is it would increase the amount of EVs over the next 2 years by approximately by 4,000. And so if you assume that the average vehicle uses, let's say, 500 watts of energy a month, that works out to about 6,500 watts over the course of a year. So that's or about 6,000 kilowatts. 6,000 kilowatts. So 6,000 times 4,000 is going to give you 2.4 2.4 megawatts, which is the math I'm doing in my head. I could be wrong, though.
That concludes your math?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Representative Neuberger?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I look here at the direction that we're taking in the legislature as a whole as we're trying to eliminate baseload energy, coal, and nuclear, and those reliable sources that we have had, as we're moving to eliminate those and try to put square pegs into round holes and call wind and solar, call them baseload. I see that we might be creating quite a demand here in how we're going to be, as we decrease reliable, affordable energy and you increase questionable energy, wouldn't it be prudent to include propane into this equation to help with any offsets that we might have as we move forward? I know as the governor would like to go to a 40% renewable, we're definitely going to have some energy shortfalls here. So I would think that having propane into this mix would be definitely part of the all-of-the-above energy inclusion package.
Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair, Representative Neuberger, as you may or may not know, propane is generally not viewed as a source for generating electricity on a base load standpoint. It is used to provide temporary power. With regards to your comments about energy sources, while I think your goals are admirable, you should point out that it does tend to be that electric car EV vehicles could actually be used as a way to save other ratepayers money if they're using off-peak meters. So, for example, at the overnight when there are many times where we have negative pricing on the grid, this is going to soak up demand. It's going to create demand by shifting demand to the middle of the night. We get the benefit of not having to create demand in the middle of the day when prices tend to be highest. Also, we tend to get rid of that reduce the amount of negative pricing overnight. Creates that demand, so it saves money. Propane does neither of those things.
Representative Garofalo, isn't it true, though, that you just really have a problem with Mr. Leitner, who has a southern accent, and that's why you don't want propane to be part of this?
No, that is not true.
Because I love a good southern accent. Anyone else on the propane issue? Representative Wagenius, you were next on the list anyway. Go ahead.
Clarification on this subsidy for electric and natural gas. Did I hear you say, or I thought I heard you say, that this was being provided by Xcel dollars?
Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair, Representative Mahoney, Representative Wagenius, sorry. the fund in question here is something, and we'll discuss this as we go through the overview of the bill tomorrow night. It creates a new energy fund, and there are multiple sources of revenue that go into the energy fund. One of those sources of revenue are the dollars that was formerly known as the Renewable Development Fund, which comes from Xcel ratepayers.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, maybe I'll just wait for my question for tomorrow night. I do have a follow-up, though.
Yes, Representative Wagenius.
Tomorrow night we will find out if the munis and co-ops are also going to be putting money into this fund, so I'll wait for tomorrow night on that one. But my other question was, are any of these electric cars manufactured in Minnesota?
Representative Mahoney. I'm sorry, you got me saying it. Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair and Representative Wagenius, 2 points. Actually, number one, you don't have to wait till tomorrow to find out if the munis and co-ops are paying. They are. The energy omnibus bill that was posted online Friday before the recess and was made with slight adjustments last night, there are $7 million in general fund appropriations that are going into the energy fund, and those are statewide appropriations that would not be limited to the Xcel service territory. With regards to your second question on the whether electric vehicles are produced in Minnesota, I tend to say I do not know the answer to that question, but I'm happy to look into it to find out if the electric vehicles being manufactured in Representative Nornes' district would qualify under this provision.
Representative Wagenius?
If I could, on this point, are you talking about buses then in Representative Nornes' district?
Representative Garofalo?
No.
Madam Chair, Representative Wagenius, no.
Okay. So can
Representative
we
Wagenius.
last question. Can we expect in the jobs portion of this bill for some incentives to have electric vehicles manufactured in Minnesota?
Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair, Representative Vaginius, again, the omnibus bill has been posted and has been released for a week and a half, and that provision is not in the bill.
I'm talking about the jobs.
Representative Vaginius.
Has that been posted for a week and a half, the jobs portion?
Madam Chair, Representative Vaginius, no, it has not.
I was talking about the jobs portion.
Please go through the chair. Representative Vaginius.
Thank you.
Finished?
Thank you.
Representative Mahoney, finally it's your turn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And while the natural gas people are coming down, I'll ask the author of the bill, seems how, am I under the impression that this is only available in the XL rate payers district, this rebate or whatever we're calling it?
Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair, Representative Mahoney, the EV portion is limited to those who reside in the Xcel service territory and as individuals, not as businesses. The natural gas portion incentives, the compressed natural gas, are statewide and are open to businesses.
Thank you.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, if the people that could answer questions about natural gas could step to the table.
Sure. Who would you like to direct your question to?
Well, either one can answer that. I'm just trying to find out. Someone told me that natural gas in a compressed natural gas vehicle is relatively high pressure, but they couldn't tell me what the pressure was. So what, and then I read in the bill, compressed natural gas vehicle is fueled entirely from natural gas, compressed to less than 1% of the volume it occupies in the standard atmospheric pressure. So, what pressure is natural gas under in a vehicle?
Mr. Williams, or are the testifier, I'm sorry, your name again?
Tony Kellen.
Thank you. Go ahead. Your answer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mahoney, that was one of the definitions that I find confusing that I was speaking about earlier. Essentially, the standard today is 3,600 PSI at 70 degrees in the cylinder. And so it can go as high as 4,200 PSI. But generally, 3,600 is what most people use as a standard.
Representative Mahoney?
I have some concerns. I don't think it's a proper place to it. That's a pretty high pressure for any kind of natural gas. I'd like to figure out, and I'll get this offline, who's installing these fueling stations, because anything over 15 pounds is high pressure. 4,200 pounds of pressure is very high. So I'll get that offline from the author of the bill. Thank you.
Any other? Representative Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Garofalo, this isn't a real developed proposal, but I wanted to talk to you about my proposal that I'm talking about. Yours is developed. Okay. What I wanted to propose to you to think about is, in a community like mine in South Minneapolis, one of our major problems in terms of environmental health is the issue of the exhaust from incredible amounts of traffic, and it looks like what you're talking about could be helpful, you know, really helpful to my community, if it was affordable, if people could afford the vehicles, or if we could somehow develop some sort of pilot, you know, in your bill or maybe later, maybe it's something for next year. But I'd like to ask you to think about the idea of where we have concentrated traffic. And it's proven to be much of a health hazard. It's very related to asthma, the mobile sources of very serious problems for inner-city populations, causes a lot of problems with kids missing school, causes a lot of other health problems. I'm just wondering if there's a way we could somehow look at the issue of affordability for some of these vehicles for the folks who really suffer the problems of the traffic. Now, I didn't hear a direct answer to Representative Scott's question about how much these vehicles cost, but if we could start talking about that, I think it would be really helpful. You might find And of course, the traffic that's passing through my neighborhood isn't all by from the people who live there. In fact, most of it is from outside of the area. But I'm wondering if you have thought about any of this in terms of the health issues of concentrated traffic on populations that are deeply impacted, and if not, it might be something we could put into the picture in terms of this bill or others that would follow.
Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair and Representative Clark, earlier in your comments you had said something that it may be helpful. And I'll just tell you, it is helpful. Mm-hmm. Actually, making these changes is helpful.
Right.
And that's why what we're looking for is the biggest bang for the buck. And the biggest bang for the buck is that when you look at heavy vehicles, garbage haulers, fleet vehicles, recyclers, those are the heavy diesel users that leave from one spot and go back to them. That's where you're going to get the best bang from the buck in terms of replacing out diesel vehicles. With regards to electric vehicles, it's clear the technology is that energy storage is getting better, it's getting bigger, it's getting cheaper. There's worldwide, there are billions of dollars of research and development going into energy storage, which not only affect vehicles, but also can potentially impact the energy market. I think in the next couple of months here, we'll have a debate tomorrow about net metering, but the next couple of months, technology may make that debate just moot. People may be able to have much more cost-effective energy storage in their home, so they don't need the net meter, but that's a separate conversation. But so Representative Clark, I think the important thing is that if we can get these heavy diesel trucks off the market, if we can have more conversions taking place, this will incentivize and build a market for more conversion facilities to then kind of start this positive feedback loop. I don't view this as something that needs to go into perpetuity, but the environmental and the economic benefits are indisputable. That's why I think we should do it.
Thank you, Representative Clark.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, great. I like where what you're talking about in terms of where that's going. I do know that a lot of the traffic that is a hazard in my district is also just from cars. I think we have something like 30,000 vehicles on one of the streets every day that goes through the middle of a housing, low-income housing project with lots of kids. So diesel, yes, that's part of it, and those trucks and those, and we are actually, you might want to help with the project that we're trying to do to prevent diesels from being increased in my immediate neighborhood. But it's also the car traffic, people commuting in and out of the city of Minneapolis. So I don't have a developed proposal here, but the more I think about it, I'm really interested in working with you in some way to address maybe the cost, because I still don't know how much they cost, but I think they're fairly expensive. And is that anything are you interested in working with me on that to some degree?
Madam Chair and Representative Clark, my door always remains open, but I will tell you that this bill is an unprecedented investment in zero tailpipe emission vehicles. I heard the testimony previously. The gentleman is right. Obviously, there are going to be some emissions from the root energy source on it. But I will tell you that under this bill, should the legislature enact it in the next 2 years, you're seeing an over 100% increase in the number of no emission tailpipe vehicles. And that's a pretty substantial commitment with a substantial environmental benefit.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Chair, I'll take that as a yes, so we can work on some opportunities together. Thank you.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. Just in follow-up to Representative Clark's question, you were talking about the heavy vehicles, but what about buses? I mean, electric buses, which would take a lot more folks and relieve a lot more. I mean, I don't know the opportunity there. Can you just tell us about the opportunity there?
Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair and Representative Wagenius, the electrification of buses really doesn't work. There's been some piloting of it nationwide, but generally speaking, where the overwhelming investment and changeover is occurring is in natural gas. They're converting buses to natural gas. Substantial price savings and substantial environmental benefits. Electric vehicles, our electric buses, there's just too much. The breakthrough in energy storage is not taking place. Certainly in the future, as energy storage gets cheaper and gets able to hold more power, that may be where we go. But right now, if you look, the vast majority of conversions are to natural gas.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Garofalo, you just said that your bill is not designed to go into perpetuity. can you name me a tax credit or a rebate that's actually gone away?
Representative Garofalo?
I got one I can name. I think the question was rhetorical, Madam Chair.
Oh, okay. Final comments, Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I just appreciate everyone's feedback, and I just want to point out, this is something that we can all, it's a win-win for everybody. Lower costs, reduced pollution, everyone wins, and it's good for America. So I'd appreciate member support. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And with that, House File 2081 is laid over. Thank you, committee. Yeah. Representative Lunin.
There's some other factors. Please. I've been in the paramedic.
Representative Lunin, would you like to move your bill?
Madam Chair, I'd like to move House File 1290.
Thank you. Representative Lunin moves House File 1290 to be laid over for possible inclusion.
Okay.
Go ahead, Representative
Madam
Lunin.
Madam Chairman and members, this bill pertains...
Representative Lunin, if we could just have it quiet in the audience, that would be very helpful. The rest of us could hear.
Order.
Order in the court, yeah. Representative Lunin, go ahead. Thank you.
This bill pertains to a tax, if you will, a fee that is charged on all automobile insurance policies that carry the coverage of comprehensive, which covers for the peril of theft. The original collection was designed to use that money, which ends up being about $2.6 million a year, to fight auto theft. Back in the days of budget balancing, this fund, half of it was robbed, $1.3 million was robbed to go into the general fund, and what we're looking for now is to hand an instrument to be used in a bill that Representative Sanders is proposing, not just to fight auto theft, but insurance fraud in general, and put the $1.3 million back into why it was originally collected. Obviously it'll have that effect on the general budget because it'll come out of there and go into that account. Other than that, it's a pretty straightforward bill.
Do you have anyone here to testify on behalf of the bill?
I do not.
Okay, anyone in the audience wishing to testify on House File 1290? Seeing no one, then we will move to member questions. Representative Metza.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one quick question. You said the fund was robbed. I was wondering if you could let us know who robbed it.
I wasn't there.
Representative Lunin.
What happens is from time to time when the legislatures have to go through and balance the books because of a balanced budget amendment, the governor, whoever that happens to be at the time, uses whatever resources are available to solve that problem. I'm not sure. I don't even know when it happened. I just know that it happened.
Representative Metz, a follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the evil culprit is former Governor Pawlenty, but I could phone a friend here who might know more.
I don't know.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Are you just calling on me because I raised my hand? Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate it. Just a question, kind of obviously comprehensive insurance, when you purchase that, that's where the money comes from. So say if I was a TNC driver currently, and I had a person that was in my car, and at the time they were a rider, and that car was to get stolen while I was under contract driving someone. Would someone actually pay into this account during that scenario or not?
Representative Lunin.
Well, first of all, let me clean up the question. It would depend on the policy on the auto. If it was a basic auto policy, which is a commercial auto policy, then there would be coverage. Nothing would be paid into this fund. This fund is to defend insurance fraud. Would the claim be covered under comprehensive under the peril of theft? Absolutely, subject to deductible. If it's a personal auto policy because the vehicle is being used for livery at the time, the policy is actually void and there is no coverage whatsoever, so that claim would not be paid.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Madam Chair, sorry. So you're saying there would be a potential gap in coverage there?
There would definitely.
Representative Lunin.
There would definitely be a gap in coverage, and this this bill isn't designed to pay those losses. We're hoping that there's a proposed bill out there that contractually will be able to solve that gap on the ever-increasing, ever-popular Uber and things of that nature.
Thank you, Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Chair Scott.
Let's see, Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Lunin. And also, if there was a situation sort of like Representative Swazinski was commenting on, and if it was a propane deliverable truck, would that also be covered if we are so lucky to get the bill changed to represent propane as they would anything else? Thank you.
Representative Lunin.
Again, if the policy on the vehicle is a basic auto policy rather than a family auto policy, then there would be coverage because just you use the word delivery, I'm assuming that that's delivering for a fee, which meets the definition of the livery exclusion.
Thank you. Representative Lunin, how much is that tax on policies? Do you know?
Pardon me?
The tax that's currently in existence, right? There's currently something on every auto policy.
Right. It's.
Do you know what that amount?
Yes, Madam Chairman. It's a dollar per year per vehicle.
Okay. Very good. Any other member questions? Seeing none, we will lay over House File 1290 for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Lunin.
Thank you, everyone.
Representative Vogel. And it looks like you have some testifiers coming down. We'll wait till they're seated.
Yes,
and
I do.
In the meantime, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. I will move House File 1977 for possible inclusion.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Vogel. Go ahead.
Thank you. House File 1977 instructs the Commissioner of Labor and Industry to adopt an energy rating index which would provide a range of options for compliance with the 2012 International Energy Conservation Code. It does not change any of the performance standards. Rather, it adds another method to provide for those standards by having the commissioner work with others to develop alternative measurements. By providing those alternatives, it will give potential homeowners the opportunity to work with their builder to gain as energy-efficient home as is possible within the budget they have to spend. It also provides more opportunity to develop new innovations in construction and conservation, which can then be used by others to achieve a better, more energy-efficient home, since all parties involved, the homeowner, builder, and code enforcer, can work toward a common goal of the most energy-efficient home at the most affordable price. Madam Chair, I have two testifiers that can give more specifics on what it is.
Good, thank you. Welcome to the committee, and I don't know who wants to go first. Go ahead and introduce your name, please, for the record, and continue with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members, James Vogley, Builders Association of the Twin Cities. I'll keep my comments brief in support of House File 1977. The recently adopted energy code has two options today: a prescriptive option and a performance option. And House File 1977 attempts to improve upon the performance option. The feedback we've received from builders in the field is that the complexity and the current constitution of the performance option is such that they aren't able to implement it. And we believe that there are pathways to fix this. And the energy rating index concept is a national concept. It's been adopted in jurisdictions in several states, and it utilizes a score. Currently, 60% of the homes built in the Twin Cities receive a HERS index, and that's a score. And it's like golf, starts at 100, and the lower the score, the better. We believe that score could be utilized by the department to create an energy rating index, and that would create a more user-friendly option for compliance. The HERS index is recognized in green building programs, the multiple listing service, and we think provides some greater flexibility for builders, homeowners, to efficiently comply with the code. The final point, I would just reiterate Representative Vogel's comments. This isn't meant to reduce or lessen the energy savings requirements. This works within that structure. This simply creates a pathway with some flexibility for home builders and homeowners.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Next testifier, please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
My name is Sam Green. I'm a building science consultant and building performance consultant. I'm consulting for the Builders Association of the Twin Cities, and I'm principal of Green Training and Consulting. The issue that we're facing right now in the current code is that there is a prescriptive alternative. There is a prescriptive or a mandatory energy code that has to be met when you build a new home. And the performance alternative that exists in the current building code doesn't really work hand in hand or work well with the HERS rating that most of the builders are getting done. So we've taken a look at this option or model of the 2015 ERI, which is a way to actually specify a HERS alternative. And that would allow a builder that was building a higher performance house that had a lower, better score to have an alternative instead of having to go with just the prescriptive mandate that every builder has to. So this wouldn't necessarily replace everyone else that's doing what the mandatory energy code is for new construction, but those builders that do have good energy performance, they would have a better option. If we tried to make that work right now with the existing code the way it's written, the HERS rating as it works does not mesh very well with that performance alternative.
Thank you, Mr. Green. Anyone else in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? Please come forward. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue on with your testimony, please.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Allison Lindberg, and I am with nonprofit organization Fresh Energy. And I did bring a handout today, which hopefully we'll get around to you, and you'll have time to read it later. But I am a policy director at Fresh Energy, and we work on policies that support clean energy and energy efficiency. And over the last 3.5 years, I have been involved with the Department of Labor and Industry and other stakeholders on the adoption of the current commercial and residential energy codes. So energy codes are an important part of our energy conservation strategy. Buildings account for about 40% of the total energy consumption in the United States. And I'm here today to express concerns about this particular bill. In general, we do not think performance compliance pathways are bad. We just believe that the language here is a little too vague, and it doesn't get us to a good place. In fact, it positions us to have a weaker version of the current energy code. And this handout that's going around explains that a little more, but I will also explain it here. So currently, compliance with the residential energy code mainly considers the building envelope. So you have the walls, you have windows, you have the roof. Permanent structures of the code. In small part, it also considers mechanical system and permanent lighting. But what an ERI does, or a HERS rating does, is it includes other items like appliances, water heaters, and solar panels to achieve this energy score. So if those items are included as part of a trade-off to reach energy code compliance, what you potentially are actually getting is less energy efficiency in the walls and windows and in the roof. So you're actually making it less than the baseline energy code. In addition, those trade-offs, like appliances, are also items that can be removed from a house. So if a homeowner were to remove an energy-efficient refrigerator, it is now no longer compliant with the current energy code. I understand this building is intended to give builders flexibility. There are reasons, though, why prescriptive requirements exist and why they're important. As just an example, you wouldn't want a builder to choose the lower cost option, the lowest cost options, and then end up with hardly any insulation in the walls. I don't think anybody wants that. That's why I think this bill is not strong enough language to prevent something like that. A building is also a system, and in order to avoid future problems like moisture issues, as an example, it needs to be treated as a system. And minimum prescriptive requirements are designed to consider measure those items like moisture issues and to account for health and safety. So if you have received this handout here, I just want to point out a few things and then feel free to read it at your leisure. So the building codes are updated every 3 years. Until we just updated this most current version, we were essentially at the IECC 2006. We skipped the 2009, we just adopted the 2012 this year, and we're not going to adopt the 2015. The 2015 is what is referenced here, and why I have it referenced is because it is the first code that has an ERI as a performance pathway. So it's new. There are a few states that have adopted it, but it is still really new. You'll see here in this little blue box that they mention the different climate zones here for Minnesota, and they do give a score that references what it should be for this climate zone. Again, the bill doesn't reference any kind of number, so that is one of our concerns. As they probably mentioned earlier, the lower the score, the more energy efficient the building. So if you turn around to the other page, to the back side, there are three different paths to achieve compliance. There's the prescriptive path, there's the existing performance path, and then the current ERI. And if you look down at the third row, you'll see that the first two actually meet, for those envelope requirements, the 2015 IECC, but this third one, the ERI, is actually much less than the 2015. It is actually the 2009 IECC, which is less than our current energy code. I realize that is a lot of jargon and a lot of acronyms, but the main point to take away is that the envelope is actually less energy efficient if you use an ERI performance pathway. And then just bringing up to another point, we are also concerned over why we need this performance option when we already actually do have a performance option in our current energy code. So in general, I just want to say that we are not against the performance-based compliance approach, but we do think the bill language is too vague to ensure that the performance pathway won't lead to homes that are built to standards less than our current energy code. Imagine if you have two homes being built. One of them is built in a prescriptive way and then has energy-efficient appliances, and then the other one is built performance-wise and has energy-efficient appliances but isn't quite as energy-efficient as the other one that's actually built to code. So you do have two different levels here, potentially. The bill does not set minimum prescriptive requirements, which we believe are really important, and it does not leave enough time for a stakeholder engagement and rulemaking process to ensure that the appropriate ERI values are established for this climate zone. So for these reasons, we have concerns about this bill, and we oppose it in its current form. And I'm happy to answer any questions, and thank you for listening.
Thank you. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Your invited testifiers have already gone, Representative Vogel?
They're still here.
Have they already testified?
They already testified, but I'm sure they could answer some questions.
I have Representative Wagenius, Hortman, and Mahoney. Representative Wagenius.
Yes, thank you. I mean, what you're proposing is going to take a substantial amount of work by the department, but I didn't see a fiscal note. What is the cost that is being projected here?
If we just go to Ms. Hendricks, because she loves being the center of attention and having everyone look at her. Ms. Hendricks.
Okay. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, a dolphin.
Okay.
There's a fiscal note on House Fall 1977, and it shows a one-time cost in fiscal year 2016 of $130,000, and this is for rulemaking by the department. Whenever rulemaking is required or the agency reads the bill as requiring rulemaking, there is an estimated cost to that, and that there are some guidelines set for that. So this is for medium rulemaking by the Department of Labor and Industry at a cost of $129,000 for just fiscal year 16.
Representative Wagenius.
This is a practical matter. I don't see how you can do rulemaking if it's contested and get it done by August
2015.
Is that a comment?
That's a comment. That's
Representative Hortman, then Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I had before the testifier got to it was whether the alternate pathway could create a situation where the home met the standard initially, but then due to the removal of some of the alternate features, then didn't really comply with the building code over time, and what the impact would be on the cost to the homeowner or the building occupant. And so I guess my concern that maybe you'd like to respond to is the testifier seemed to indicate under the your proposal, the owner of a building could end up with bigger energy costs in the future because the building doesn't really meet code based on its envelope. It's just these enhanced features. And what's your response on that
to topic? Either the testifiers?
Sure, that's a great question. That issue could happen even in a current home built to current energy code. Someone could come in later and swap out the LED light bulbs, which were originally part of the HERS rating, and an assumption of energy performance over its lifetime, and put in worse performing light in the future. They could also choose other types of a dishwasher, for example, that wasn't Energy Star certified, but maybe the builder had originally installed it that way. There are things like that that can be modified as the building goes on. What the HERS rating endeavors to do is to take into account all the things that can be modeled that are supposed to be permanently installed. And that usually includes not just space heating and cooling, domestic hot water, but it also takes into account the appliances, lighting, things like that. Those can vary through the lifetime of the house, but the other things too that cause people's energy bills to fluctuate, as you well know, are things that get plugged in voluntarily after the move-in. So, and those can't really be figured into the model, into that score. So if someone puts a hot tub in later, we can't really calculate that. But there is a lot of variety there. What we're hoping is that that this possibility, and I should just clarify, this possibility would be not for an underperformer to somehow get across the line. This would be for someone who is already performing above and beyond the minimum requirements. And then they could actually get credit for that additional work instead of having to be forced to do all the additional work. And that's kind of an overgeneralization, but there are a lot of ways that a builder can do that, and some builders currently are, and they would like to get credit for it.
Representative Hartman.
My follow-up is to you, Mr. Chair. This seems like an energy policy bill, and I'm wondering, we're well after the deadline, so am I right in presuming that this didn't make deadline in either the House or Senate and couldn't be included in the bill?
Representative Hortman, you are mistaken. This is a Finance Committee, and so our deadline is the Finance Committee deadlines.
So we don't...
Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we don't need to abide by those rules?
Representative Hortman, we do abide by those rules, but this is a Finance Committee.
They don't apply to us, the policy deadline.
That is correct, Representative Hortman.
Thank you.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the author or the testifiers, where is the Department of Labor and Industry and the Code Enforcement Group on this particular bill?
To the testifiers.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, we've discussed this with the Department of Labor and Industry. I think we've made progress. We're not there yet. I don't think we've reached consensus. We're hoping that as this issue moves forward, we'll be able to achieve that. But they've engaged in this discussion, and so far we've made progress.
Representative Mahoney.
Well, I have a couple of concerns, so I'm just going to continue to go here. Rulemaking, you know, and I actually have this one written down, takes at least a year to adopt. To go through the rulemaking process, and then takes 180 days required to make the rule effective. We just had a bill, I think, from Representative Gunther's committee from the Minnesota Builders Association, stretching out code adoption an extra year. So, actually, the code implementation for an extra 90 days or a year. It's getting confusing at this time of night. So your August 15th date is kind of already blown past. My concern here, though, is that you know, years ago I had to do a few things on an energy code, and the moisture issue that was brought up was one of my more favored items to deal with. Just go ask the Commerce Committee. So one of the things that the energy code does is it has a full page of alternatives that you can use. I mean, you can't find something in a full page of code that could allow you to work together. I mean, that's the way the code was built, so that people could, if you have an engineer that signs off on it, you can make it work. So what is the problem in here? I'm not understanding this.
That's a great question. The issue at hand with the current code, there is, you're absolutely right, there's the prescriptive code, then there is a performance alternative.
Yeah. And in that, you didn't have the performance code earlier.
So that current code as it's written is not similar to the ratings that builders are getting right now. That is slightly different in the sense that it only takes into account it has to model to use less energy per year than the code-built house for space heating and cooling and domestic hot water use only. So then the HERS rating just by itself currently, which the majority of the houses, the majority of the new homes built are being done using that rating method, that doesn't just show a builder that metric. So they would have to redesign what they're doing right now to make it mesh with the current performance alternative. So that amount of work to make that mesh together compared to this ERI alternative is a much more straightforward step, which is why it's so appealing from our standpoint. And that answers your question a little bit.
Representative Mahoney.
Yeah, you answered the question. I just don't kind of buy into it, but the other issue is that because builders don't build the same house this year that they built last year. They are constantly changing, whether it's the methods that they build, the materials that they use, the designs that they use. He went on the Parade of Homes, and the guy commented on the newspaper. Everyone's got a peak. What happened? They change them every year. What's the problem with going through the process? Because we as a state 10 years ago set up a process to take this through and worked through with everybody else. Why would you come to the legislature and substitute that? Because someday you may have someone that wants a legislator that... And this chair would never do it because he would really think out the bill first. But maybe another chair would come in and decide to put a different standard in and run it through. That's why we put it all over at the Department of Labor and Industry with the requirement that they get all the stakeholders together. You came to this committee trying to break that compact, and you may rue the day. I don't understand. Why are you doing this?
To the testifiers.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, I think the best response I can give is the system of 10 years ago. We think this new innovation, if you will, with the Energy Rating Index is an improvement. And that's why we're here. We certainly remember vividly the concerns, the moisture intrusion, and the energy code problems we had previously. And I think the builders, as they've communicated to us, they believe the energy rating index is an improvement upon that compact.
So, Mr.
Representative
Chair,
Mahoney.
Just a closing comment, because I want to be done just as bad as anybody else. If this is a good idea, they should be able to sell it to the professionals rather than a pipe fitter or a... union thug or a or a restaurateur or a computer geek or a grocer. Go sell it to the people who understand.
To the testifiers, this is how to make friends and influence people. Right here, this is good. So,
thank you. Go with the bill if you want. But
thank you, Representative Mahoney. Representative Vogel, any closing comments?
Well, other than feeling a little incompetent now as a banker relative to the expertise needed here and myself promoting this, you know, when this came to me, one of the things I was looking at is trying to be innovative and keeping housing affordable. I remember when we built our house, and back then, and I know it's been a long time, if you spend $100 a square foot on that house, you had a mansion. Now, you can't get by for less than $150 to $200. And what we're doing is making it so difficult for people to afford houses that my feeling is we have to be somewhat innovative and maybe step a little bit beyond where we're comfortable with, especially in the rulemaking process, and bring in the conversation and the collaboration you're going to have between the builders, the code people, and the homeowner who is actually paying for this thing long term. So I guess, is it perfect? Maybe no, but I think that the idea of bringing that conversation to the forefront with doing something like this is well worth the effort, and hopefully, like I said, we keep homes affordable so that people can actually achieve that dream of having a home.
With that, Representative Vogel renews his motion to have House File 1977 laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you, Representative Vogel. Representative Mahoney? Representative Mahoney moves House File 716 for possible inclusion in a later bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 716 is a Port Authority bill, St. Paul Port Authority bill. It does a number of different things. The biggest thing is that it changes the name from the Port Authority of St. Paul to the St. Paul Port Authority, and that which allows it to work easier with other political entities, such as was it last year, the year before, they had the big fire up at the Sartell Lumberyard, paper mill, and the Port Authority came up there and helped Sartell figure out what to redo with that. It clarifies that when the terms of the commissioners start and stop, it clarifies that, and I never thought they did do this, but it's puts in the law that they can't take land owned by Ramsey County without authorization from Ramsey County. That would make sense. Most of the rest of it is technical. It adds some rules on the river bluff and adjacent land, abutting land. That's the bill, Mr. Chair, and I have Lori Lauder from the Port, who is their government relations person, answer any questions or give some testimony.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Lori Lauder. I'm the Senior Vice President of Business and Intergovernmental Affairs for the St. Paul Port Authority. This really is, as we see it, Mr. Chair, a housekeeping bill. There are certain technical changes, as Representative Mahoney indicated, and I would stand for questions in the interest of time.
This is a public hearing. Are there members of the public which testify in favor or voice concerns of the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion and go to member questions. Representative Szczesinski and then Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This would be either to the testifier or to Representative Mahoney. Now, you say it's just a housekeeping bill. There isn't a potential conflict or project that's going on that would be impacted by this right this very moment or something you're trying to do this and then in preparation for? Or is it just simply?
To the testifier?
I think, Mr. Chair, Representative no, it is not. And I think what you're referring to is some of the closing of locks in Minneapolis and has nothing to do with that at all.
Okay.
Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering, Representative Mahoney, in line 1.12, would you be open to a verbal amendment to change St. Paul to Iron Range?
He's a tug.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Mahoney?
I don't think they've quite finished the port on Lake Vermilion, so once that's done, I might certainly be open to it.
Fired. Representative Mahoney, any other questions for members of the committee? Representative Mahoney, a serious question. In the repealer language, there is a provision under current law, the City of St. Paul has to give consent for the Port Authority to issue revenue bonds. This repeals that. Does the testifier want to address that point, and is there any opposition to it?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you for the question. There are two repealers here, and we did check prior to this session with the City of St. Paul, and they have no problems with it. As to the review and approval of the City Council on revenue bonds, it really is a redundant process. Revenue bonds, as you may know, do not carry with it any general obligation of the city, so the City of St. Paul thought that this was redundant since the Port Authority's Board of Commissioners would make such ruling. And then the other repealer has to do with employees, and none of us can figure out where that law came from to begin with or why it was.
Neither can I. So, okay. Representative Mahoney, any closing comments?
Good bill. Please include it in your omnibus bill.
With that, Representative Mahoney renews his motion to have House File 716 laid over for possible inclusion. Members, that completes our agenda. Again, tomorrow will be a big day. I should have said it earlier, and I guess I'll remind myself to say it tomorrow, that in the event that we are somehow able to get everything completed and posted online early, we'll make that announcement through the listserv and through the Twitter account. So follow the Twitter account at
Twitter.
Oh, the committee has a Twitter account. It does. Yes, it is. What is the Twitter account?
Propane.
No. This, we'll tell you tomorrow. So, and you should know staff has taken my access away from it. It was a very big fight. With that, we are adjourned for the evening. Thank you, everyone.